There's a legend round here. A killer buried, but not dead. A curse on Crystal Lake. A death curse. Jason Voorhees' curse. They say he died as a boy, but he keeps coming back. Few have seen him and lived. Some have even tried to stop him. No one can. People forget. He's down there, waiting.
And welcome to Friday, May the 13th edition of Dead Pit Radio. It's Friday the 13th.
Combining two of our favorite things, though, which is May of the Dead and Friday the 13th into one spectacular.
Yeah. It is kind of bizarre that all the years we've been doing this that we've never done a Friday the 13th on May of the Dead.
I know. I guess we never really planned for this either. But I mean, what we decided to do seemed to work out pretty well because it does actually have both elements of May of the Dead and Friday the 13th in it.
Look, Jess, you need to focus on this damn show. Quit writing your stupid notes. So this is the first Friday the 13th show we've done with Jesco, which is probably a pretty good thing, actually.
So what we've decided to do, I mean, we do have an interview, by the way, and we haven't really talked about that on the show per se, but the interview we've got is with Tom McLaughlin, who is the director of Friday the 13th Part 6, as well as One Dark Night, and Sometimes They Come Back, and all kinds of other stuff, too, that you might have seen on TV. We've got a really, really long interview with Tom.
Yeah, which is why that's going to be the majority of the show. It's like a 90-minute interview, and you know, there's just so much horror news you can put in 1 week show, and like, there's not a lot going on right now. So we figure, hell, we'll just play the whole goddamn interview.
Yeah, and I mean, that way we want to use up every week we have in May of the Dead too. You know, for a special interview.
Yeah, so or segment.
Yeah, we're going to definitely do that. But what we've decided to do in lieu of any kind of reviews or anything else like that is we've talked ad nauseum about the Friday the 13th series. I mean, I swear to God, I know we've talked about it at least 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and we've talked about it numerous times with people that have called in, too, when we did the call-ins.
And, I mean, if you think about this, how amazing this is, too. We've actually done interviews with the guy that directed Friday the 13th, Part 5, Part 6, Part 7.
Mm-hmm.
We've interviewed all the directors of those movies. And, I mean, if you went back and listened to all the interviews we've done that actually had Friday the 13th alumni in it, it's amazing. We've got Adrian King on, Tom Savini on, Betsy Palmer on.
Amy Steele. Steve Dash.
We've had Tom Morga and friggin', God almighty, just.
Carol Locatell.
Anybody you can, from Part 5, pretty much anybody you
Melanie
can think
Kahneman.
Of.
I was actually trying to put a list together of all the people we've had over the years. Like, we had Harry Manfredini, and it's just been a little crazy, actually. It seems like after Part 5, though, we really don't have that many people from the movies after Part 5.
I mean, honestly, the characters in Part 7 and 8, with the exception of maybe the female leads, are really not that memorable to me. I mean, I really don't remember anything about them. Well, we had John Carl Beekler on, who directed Part 7, and we have done that. I guess the main one that's missing at this point would probably be Kane Hodder, but it's my understanding he really doesn't do stuff like that. No, audio interviews a lot anyway.
Yeah, and I think Steve Miner's another one that probably will never do an interview.
No.
So.
And Sean Cunningham, he just did like Monster Mania, but he's never been, he didn't just do it. I think he's going to do it, but he's never been really known to do anything like that up to this point either.
So, who left in Friday the 13th would you like to hear on the show, Jess?
I don't know. I don't know. The only thing I can...
Quit braiding you fucking hair.
Quit braiding something me. You got everybody except, like, the big names. I wonder if Corey Feldman wouldn't do anything, would he?
The big... Yeah, we suck. We can't...
Well, Corey Feldman wouldn't do anything.
No, we had an opportunity to interview Corey Feldman one time. It was going to be for about 15 minutes about Lost Boys 3 or something.
You can only talk to Corey Feldman about Lost Boys 3. That's the rule.
Maybe, well, you could probably slip something in there without him really.
Not really. So,
what would he do, hang up?
Well, the problem with interviews like that, they usually got an agent on the line with them. And, like, if you try to ask anything that's not approved, the agent cuts off the interview.
But why would he cut something off like that?
Because they're dicks.
He probably just wouldn't answer it. He'd probably just, let's go on the next question. We're talking about Lost Boys 3.
Lost Muertos.
Okay, so you think Lost Boys 3 is better than Friday the 13th 4?
He'd be like, yeah, it's awesome. It's the best thing I've ever done. I'd ask him about Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys. He's in that movie.
Okay, but... You're right, though. Corey Feldman would be a good one. I'd love to have Corey Feldman on for, like, an interview like we do, which would be, like,
hell, not even
long.
About fucking Friday the 13th, though, but all this shit. Fuck that.
I mean, Lost Boys and Stand By Me and...
You could even talk to him about Lost Boys 3 and just make fun of it.
He probably thinks that's seriously a good movie, though, is a sad thing.
Yeah, but that's a horrible movie.
Anyway, though,
not as bad as Lost Boys 2, though.
I think that
Lost Boys 2.
Our list of Friday the 13th alumni cannot be matched by any other horror radio show. They're all chumps.
That's true.
Yeah. But, like, we have talked about Friday the 13th so much that it's really hard for us to actually keep it fresh, you know, where people actually, it sounds like something we actually do want to talk about. But the interview with Tom McLaughlin actually coming up in a little bit is primarily about Friday the 13th 6, but we talk about other stuff as well. It's like a 90-minute interview. But what we did want to do is, I guess we can talk about three or four of them before we get to the interview. We want to talk to Jess about Friday the 13th. And Jess is really excited about it too, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Talking about, like, you said that you like primarily the first, what, 4 or 5, and then after that it's like...
Yeah, I like the first, like, up to 5. Those are the most memorable for me. Those are the ones I usually stop at. I don't really get past 5.
Tom McLaughlin's not going to like to hear that, because he directed Part 6.
I'm not even saying anything about them, if they're bad or they're good. I just don't ever really get past 5.
Well, how about this part? We talk about 1 through 5, okay? Now, for me, when I was a kid, I didn't like Part 1. I don't know what you thought, because, like, I guess by the time you were old enough to...
comprehend anything.
Yeah,
you were in your 20s. You were in your 20s before I even started walking.
No, but the series was pretty much, the Paramount series was pretty much over with by the time you were able to watch the movies and actually get what was going on. I mean, it ended in like 89, you know, the Paramount series.
Well, when they started coming out, I didn't know any better because I was such a kid.
Yeah.
But even then, there's tons of movies. Like Evil Dead, You guys couldn't comprehend that when that came out.
We couldn't see it, though. That was the thing.
But you still really liked it when you had an opportunity to...
Woo! I didn't get to see Evil Dead until I was like 15 or 16 years old.
Me neither.
Because it was so hard to find on video.
Well, okay, let's talk about the first movie then. You remember the first movie. I mean, everybody remembers the first movie. What kind of... Did you like it? Did you hate it? What kind of impact did it have on you? Did it have any kind of impact on you?
I liked it a lot. I don't remember how old I was when I first seen it, but it got to the point when that was probably the movie that, like a lot of people, made you afraid to be outside when it was dark at night, even when I would go take the trash out.
Did it make you afraid of old women?
No, maybe... I was afraid Betsy Palmer would pop up. What are you doing? What are you taking the garbage out? That's okay. I'm just going to take this machete and chop your head off.
I don't know, though. Like, ever since I was a little kid, though, like, I have to look at that movie as separate from the other, because it is, really. It's a separate movie. It's definitely the best made, I think, of the whole series, like, technically. But I remember even as a young kid, like, watching it, and at the end, too, especially where Adrian King and Betsy Palmer are fighting it out and shit. And all this stuff happens where Adrian King has Betsy Palmer down, but she doesn't finish her off. She just runs away. And I remember even as a young kid being like, what the fuck? You're dumber than hell. Finish her off.
Honestly, though, I think that just in terms of film and the way that they looked, I think that part six, and this is no shit, just not just because... We got an interview with the guy that directed on here. Probably looks the best, like most professional of any of the Friday the 13th movies in terms of the way a movie should look. I think the first one was unique in like everything that they tried to do with the having, you know, Betsy Palmer be the killer and all that stuff too. Spoiler there though, by the way, if you didn't know that, you fucking obviously shouldn't be listening to the show.
Yeah. But so, okay.
You know Tom Savini did the makeup for that, by the way, Friday the 13th?
Not the first one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. I found that on his flipping that Crystal Lake Memories book.
Yay.
Part two. Now, what are your thoughts on it? Because this is the one with Tater Sack Jason throughout it.
I mean, I like it because it was just... I don't know, just because they're classics to me. So I like them. I sit down and watch them, even if I'll have it in the background. No, it wasn't anything that was too special for me. It didn't really do much. It didn't. That's probably one I'll put in just to watch in the background and not really care if I'm watching or not.
Yeah, this is the one where, like, the beginning of it, everyone, or a lot of people at least, are like, which one was the part two? You know, because it's sort of kind of gets lost in the shuffle. It's the one where the little kid's playing in a puddle at the beginning, singing Along Came a Spider or something like that. And they kill off Adrian King in that one. And
that's the one that extremely long, that they go back and pretty much play all the first one for the first 10 minutes of the movie.
And it was done like not even a year after the first one, I don't think, it came out. And that was the thing for a little while with the Friday the 13th movies.
I always like the ending of that movie, though. I don't really like the movie that much, but I actually like the Amy Steele character, and I like her role in it.
She's hot.
But I think the ending is probably one of my favorite endings in any of the Friday the 13th movies.
Something else, too, for those that have Blu-ray players out there. The Blu-ray of that is amazing looking.
It is, yeah.
I don't know.
Remember we watched it on Blu-ray?
For a low budget.
That was the best one. The second one was the best one.
The third one looked like shit.
On Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It didn't really even matter. It didn't matter if you had it on Blu-ray.
They had both versions on, like, one disc, and it just, I don't know, the 3D suck anyway. But the movie, I know that you really liked the third one.
I love the third one. Third one's my favorite one. I don't know why. It's really cheesy and stupid, and I like the whole... thing where they overdid the 3D when they made things in your face, because 3D wasn't it just coming out around then?
Yeah, I think that style 3D, they released like three or four movies that year. It was that one, Jaws, Amityville.
Mm-hmm. And then when Nightmare on Elm Street, the 3D.
Well, that was a little later.
Was that later?
I think that was a different 3D too.
Yeah.
But in 80, I think that part three was like 82, they were like, two or three movies that came out that year that was using that same technology.
Yeah, that movie just catered to the 3D, the whole 3D thing that was popular around then. And
I've never seen it in 3D, like the proper 3D.
I seen it in, with the glasses, with the blue and red.
Well, that's
red.
Not the way it... The way it was meant is actually similar to the way they do 3D now. The shutter glasses and shit.
Shutter glasses? What are shutter glasses?
That's what they use in the 3D. The 3D glasses, that's what they used back then.
Huh.
Used to be like, they had the red and, what was it, red and blue?
Yeah, the red and blue glasses.
That's not what they used with that one, though. That was like the 50s era 3D shit.
Yeah, well, I like the 50s era blue.
That doesn't work, though. The 3D never works. I've never.
It does when you watch it at home.
Well, I never thought it worked.
It does just for a little bit.
Well, here's the thing.
Well, I mean, it doesn't pop out.
No, that's the
thing.
And to me, that was really what 3D was about. Like, if it it makes it look like the images come out like a pop-up book or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But
nothing really, like, comes out of the screen.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, though, is the 3D for Friday the 13th 3 wasn't the red and blue glasses. That's just what they did it for home.
Oh.
Yeah, they used, like, this glasses that were similar to the ones that we use now.
Okay.
So, beyond that, though, like, what is it that you liked about the movie? Like, what was that your favorite?
Just that it was really stupid and cheesy. I just, like, Shelley, what was his name?
Shelley.
No, the guy's name.
Oh, Larry Zerner, the actual guy's name?
I liked him. Like, his whole thing, because I like how...
I like him, too.
Yeah. The creepy, how he was just a dorky kid that everybody hated, and he ended up being kind of nice, and you felt sorry for him,
yeah.
And then you forget that there's the killer out there, because you're so focused on the fact that you've pitied this poor guy.
Well, I mean,
it was just probably me.
I think up to that point, that was the first one that actually had more than one or two characters you could remember in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that one, Part 3 did have a lot of... likable characters and just people that you remember, like they had the Cheech and Chong.
I think
couple.
They just exaggerated all the characters in that movie so much that
it was campy. It was really stupid.
Yeah.
But Part 3 is pretty
bad.
Movie.
I like the bad guys, the biker group that
followed
them to their campsite and they were gonna cause all the problems, and the biker chick with the chains.
And the one guy just comes back at right the end.
The one that looks just like Claire Huxtable, though.
Yeah.
I always thought that. I swear to God, for years I thought that was Felicia Rashad or whatever that played Claire Huxtable. It looks just like her. I go back and watch that movie.
Part 3, I guess it was like a year, maybe 2 years later, you had the fourth one, which was supposed to be in the final chapter.
Mm-hmm.
We all know how that turned out. What do you think about the fourth one was the one with Corey Feldman, and you also had Crispin Glover.
I don't know. For some reason, I always skipped past that one, too. I don't know why that much.
Well, that seems to be a lot of people's favorite one, though.
Like, I don't know. I watched it, and I just... The one I remember the most is 1, 3, and 5. That one I knew Corey Feldman. I'd seen it a few times. I just never really cared that much to pay attention to it.
Oh, you're going
to
make people mad.
Oh, I know. It's fine.
Yeah, Scab Boy's head just fucking blew off.
Well,
somewhere.
I'm sorry.
God damn it.
I didn't know my life was being...
Four, though.
By Friday 4.
You remember 4, though.
Yeah, I do remember
4. You had the twins. The twins were
really
there.
Didn't really care, though, to pay that close attention to it.
I thought the look of Jason was the best that he looked up to that point, for sure. Because he had long fucking fingernails, and he just looked grimy and dirty and shit.
I think as a movie goes, it's one of the best ones. Like, just from beginning to end, like, with the characters and the look of Jason, like you said, the kills. Savini being back probably helped a lot with that, too. And it's definitely one of the better made altogether Friday the 13th movies.
Yep. So, I guess we've got to move onward. We won't take all day. The New Beginning, A New Beginning, Part 5, Friday the 13th, 5, which a lot of people seem to hate on. What are your thoughts, Jessica?
I liked it. I did.
Well, what's your thoughts on the argument, though? People say it's not Jason.
I don't know why they got a big problem with it. It's just another Friday movie. You got them all up to that point. What's the big argument? I don't know what the issue is at all.
That it's not Jason, it's Roy.
It's just not that big of a deal. I mean, it's a Friday movie. They just have to accept it. It happens all the time in so many movies. Everybody's got to have a big problem with it because they don't believe it's somebody. Just deal with it.
It's Roy, and I'm gay.
It ain't no big thing.
I do think, though, that people take the small parts of movies that overall the movie in and of itself is completely unbelievable, and they'll take like a small part of it like that and be like, well, that sucks.
They blow it up and make a big deal of it. This is a movie.
Well, that's always, though, that's the thing, like I always say, that is 100% of the time the complaint with Friday the 13th 5 is it isn't Jason. And what I always say is, it's a motherfucker in a hockey mask killing people. It's never fucking Jason. Jason's just the fucking name of a character.
It's true.
And like
they want to argue because it goes back to the first one. Have a problem with something.
Yeah.
But there
are people out there that take these movies like uber fucking seriously.
Yeah. And then
like that are purists about the movies and like that want, it has to be Jason and it has to be like a certain way and all this stuff. But
well, they got news because that movie's been long since made and they
need to settle it down.
Ain't nothing they can do about it now.
The thing is, like, I always thought part five had the best characters throughout. I mean, a lot of it is dark comedy, but a lot of people don't agree with it. I mean, shit, I don't know how many times we've defended the movie and people just don't care, but I mean, that's just going to be.
Well, if you look at the people that made them, part five is an exploitation movie. It really is. Like, everything about it is an exploitation movie. The nudity and the violence and everything about it. You look at part six, and part six is like a monster movie. It's like a fucking, it is just like a Frankenstein movie or something, but with a killer in it. So you got to consider the sources of who made the movies and things like that, too, I think. Yeah.
I like the beginning of Friday 5 with the kid with the axe.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. The kid was he's such a slob with a friggin' candy bar.
And it's chocolate all over his face.
It's like he was like a retard. And it's like everybody was so annoyed by him that I felt like chopping his head off.
What I always thought was funny, too, is in the dream sequence, I guess, in the very beginning where Corey Feldman is in the very beginning of part five, where the guys are like having the biggest party ever digging up Jason's grave. And they dig like, what, about 2 inches into the ground?
Yeah.
I guess fucking Larry Steinman was like, who gives a shit? Fucking he's.
I'll be like digging a hole.
Like his big toes up out of the ground or something. They just buried him. They threw some dirt over him, laid him on the ground.
Well, they had to have the kid. They had to have the actor. Who played him?
You mean Jason?
Yeah.
That was Tom Morgan, that one.
He had like a little straw coming out of the ground.
I swear to God,
we interviewed Tom Morgan, too. That was not one of the better interviews.
You probably going to kill me for this, but I can't also remember. Did we ever interview Ted White?
Mm-mm.
We didn't, did we?
Oh my God.
Buddy, Ted White's one of the funniest motherfuckers I've ever heard, though. He was on that panel, and Felcher did the panel and stuff. He is one of the most, like, stubborn.
Oh, he's very,
ornery fucking men that I've ever heard interviewed.
He's really like, into himself.
Michael Felcher said something like, this was hilarious. He said something to him, like, about the special effects in the movie were really good or something like that. And Ted White goes, it ain't special effects, it's makeup effects.
Yeah. It was funny. It was just
everything he said, Ted White had some kind of like comeback, like correcting him or something.
That's hilarious.
I would love to have him, you guys interview him just to hear him correct everything.
No, we could probably get him. I mean, I think Sean Clark represents him, so.
No, he was the only guy up there in that panel that really, he really did not like the idea of that movie or how it came off or anything. No. Really.
But anyway, I guess we should get to our interview and we'll get back and we're going to talk about everything part six on. And Jess doesn't really have anything to say about those, I don't think. But we're going to make her say something. She's being honored like Ted White.
She gonna cry now.
We'll give her pickle. Let her park her up a little bit.
He likes pickle dipped in horseradish.
This is a 90-minute interview that we did with Tom McLaughlin from Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Jason lives here on Of the Dead on Friday. The 13th. On DeadBeard.com.
Tell us about how you got started in films and what movies really inspired you to make that your career.
I had a kind of an unusual background that got me into the movies. It actually was through my dad in a whole different way. I mean, in the film industry, usually people get in through, some sort of relationship. Lots of times it is relatives, and other times it's just friends or neighbors or whatever. Somebody opens the door and you go. In my case, my dad, who was a stage performer in vaudeville and so on, came from Detroit to Los Angeles to go to USC Film School in the 1940s, right after the war. And when he graduated from film school, nobody in Hollywood wanted some guy out of film school. It made no sense because it's like, well, who do you know? Well, I know stuff, but I don't know anybody. So he ended up, not really getting going on doing a film career, but he acted in some movies and was also a magician and a fire eater. So he's, he appears in a lot of those movies from the late 40s, early 50s, if there's a carnival or circus or whatever. If there's a fire eater, that's Pop. So he basically, I was born in Santa Monica, but he bought a home in Culver City, literally right next to the MGM studios. So I grew up with his dream, about how great movies were. He would take me to films, took me to the first James Bond movie, which really got me into that. I've, watched the Universal horror movies because it used to be very cost efficient to, if you were going to run Frankenstein, you'd run it 5 nights in a row, at 9 o'clock, or the next week it might be Dracula or the Wolfman or whatever. So if you were a kid and you loved that stuff, you could see that movie 5 times, in a row, in a week. Mm-hmm. So that got very much into my blood. Plus, on the weekends, I would take his film equipment and my friends, and we would literally hop the fence and go into the back lot of MGM and make our little kid movies. Some of them never got finished because, you run out of money, or some of them, the film got damaged, or some of them the film never even came back after you send it off for processing. But it pretty much was in my blood, particularly with his encouragement that, if you want to do this, just go out and do it. Don't go to film school. So I didn't. I literally took jobs from being a magician and actor to, in the 60s, rock and roll came in, but the Beatles hit, the English rock and roll came in.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely shifted gears and went into that world for at least 4 or 5 years as a lead singer of a rock group, and we opened for the Doors and Iron Butterfly and the Animals, a lot of the 60s acts. And I still loved film and still went to film constantly, but I wasn't sure if I was going to be, the next American Mick Jagger or what. But come about 1969, I then, quit the rock thing, mainly because all the people that I really idolized had died of drug overdoses. And Jim Morrison, who I'd worked with, and Jimi Hendrix, who I saw at Monterey Pop Festival, and Janis Joplin, and on and on. Everybody, it was like a spiral that started to happen. And I thought, maybe this isn't what I want to do. And I ended up going off to Paris and studying over there acting, pantomime, with Marcel Marceau, fencing, acrobatics, and all types of, stagecraft, and put together essentially a one-man physical comedy act that was an offshoot more of like more traditional physical comedy, not so much the typical mime thing, but more like silent sketches and things that I did. And that led to me wanting to make short films like Chaplin and Keaton and Jacques Tati, some way to tell stories but totally visually. So I created a film entity called Cinemine Productions, which my feeling was that was, you know, just visual cinema to put the emphasis on what you see, not so much what you hear. So the first thing out the gate, obviously, was One Dark Night, and so much of One Dark Night was actually shot without sound, or just ambient sound, because, you know, I love that idea of someone being alone in a mausoleum, and, you know, and the scary aspect of that. And that came from when I was in Paris. I went down into the catacombs in Paris, and I broke away from the tour group. And in those days, you were just given a candle. That was your only illumination. So to suddenly be walking around in these caverns with wall-to-wall skulls and bones from hundreds of years of cemeteries that had been dug up and all those things just stacked underground there. First time I ever felt supernatural fear. Like there's nobody running after me, nothing's happening, but it's just that whole idea that these are all dead people. And, you know, and I didn't have anybody else around because I pulled from the group. And so that was, that was that shiver up the back, you know, where the hairs go up on your neck. And I thought, this, I got to remember this for something. And that was sort of the thing that, you know, kicked One Dark Night off, was that idea of having to spend the night in a mausoleum, which is very clean and antiseptic. But then, you know, suddenly the crypts open up and the coffins come out and the bodies, you know, that are all decayed and, you know, with the, you know, they call it maggots and pus. And, you know, I just substituted all that instead of blood and thought it would be much more, you know, Edgar Allan Poe-ish. To kind of go that direction.
Now,
so that kind of took me into the horror world.
I'm curious, like, did you want to be in that genre? I mean, is that something that you had aspirations to do, like a lot of horror films, or is that just that just kind of happened because of that trip?
Well, you know, I've always loved them. As I said, I was one of those kids that pretty much was sort of a loner. I mean, I had friends, but I really lived in my head, you know, in a kind of a fantasy world. And part of that was also identifying with Frankenstein as kind of a freak, you know, a monster, a guy that, you know, had a, you know, people were afraid of. But there was a loneliness to it. And the same thing, the Wolfman and Dracula. I mean, there's a fabulous, if you ever get a chance to see it, thing called Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue. It's a documentary that I was a part of with a bunch of other, horror film guys, and we all kind of lay it out, you know, what our influences were and, you know, what horror is all about. And it's, I mean, you can get it on Netflix or pretty much any place, but, you know, that answers a lot of these questions too. And you know, get to hear it from a whole bunch of different guys. But it, you know, as I said in there, that I loved monster movies because I always felt like I was the monster and they didn't scare me, you know, as much as I kind of related to it. But then once I got into the physical comedy stuff, then I was like, no, I want to do, you know, funny. I want to make, you know, things comical. And I love hearing people laugh. But when I wrote some comedy scripts, but when I hit upon this horror idea, it was right at the time when all the slasher movies were being done. So I couldn't get it off the ground because they go, hey, there's no guy with a knife and no girls and, you know, being cut up and naked and all this stuff. I said, well, this is the way I want to do it, though, and kind of held to it, and eventually, you know, it happened. So then the next film, obviously, was Friday the 13th, where now I am doing a slasher movie, but I said, well, I want to make him undead, you know, unstoppable, and every kill in that, you cannot imitate. A human being cannot do what Jason does in that movie, which also gave me a sense of, okay, I'm not giving, you know, wackos something to copy here. At the same time, I put a lot of humor in it, and that was one of the things that I was sort of insistent on, that, you know, can I make these people likable so that when they get killed, it's like, oh, I liked him or her, you know, they were funny. And so that, you know, that helped that movie, I think, actually get good reviews because I was sort of making fun of the genre, yet at the same time trying to deliver, you know, what the audience had expected. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was sort of that perfect hybrid of both things, you know, having some comedy as well as having, you know, the horror movie. And then I veered right back into the, you know, pure comedy and stuff with Date with an Angel, and then back to horror again with Stephen King. Sometimes they come back, you know, and then it started to merge between, like, reality monsters, you know, serial killers, AIDS, global warming, mental illness, the DC Sniper, Michael Skakel. I mean, the monsters went from fantasy monsters, that was the world of Stephen King and Universal Horror, to reality, you know, and the monsters that we all have to deal with in society, or the curses. So always trying to find a good side, not a good side to the thing, but a good side to the people involved, because sometimes it's, like in the case of mental illness and things, it's nothing that you can control once it gets out of control. Or the DC Sniper, you know, my goal in that was to do a father and son story, because these two guys really needed each other. You know, Muhammad needed a son because his wife took away his kids, and this kid didn't have any father figure in his life. But instead of going out hunting and fishing, they went hunting and shooting people. And he got, you know, he'd feed that boy if he did a single headshot. So, I mean, it's very twisted, very monstrous, scared the shit out of everybody in this country and, you know, overseas. And it was all two guys that, you know, were living in a car together and just arbitrarily picking these victims. And then it just took off as, oh, this is a terrorist plot. So, you know, the media and our imaginations turned them into, you know, a whole far greater thing than that what they really were. But at the core of the whole thing was, you know, two lonely guys, you know, that were acting like father and son, staying at the YMCA together. And, I mean, it's just very bizarre. But that, to me, is what was so interesting. And so, you know, it wasn't the kind of monster that you think of. I mean, Frankenstein, you know, is a sad figure. You know, he's pieced together with body parts and brought to life. And, you know, he didn't ask for this. Dracula wanted to stay dead. The Wolfman certainly didn't want to go around tearing, you know, necks out. But, you know, that's what I always related to, with the fact that there was this heartbreaking aspect to it. So it made the monster all the more sympathetic and yet frightening, because he had an agenda.
Going back a little bit, though, to One Dark Night, which I just got to see it actually a couple of years ago for the first time. What kind of a release did that get back in the day when it came out? And did you find that it was hard at the time because there were so many of the horror movies around the early, you know, the early 80s era to get it properly distributed in theaters?
Well, here's the interesting thing about that one, boys. I took that script around, me and my friend Mike Hawes, who co-wrote it with me, for quite a few years. And I could, like, as I said, most people said, well, gee, it's, you know, it's not a slasher movie. And it's like, yeah. And they didn't know if it would work. And so it was basically no. And we had like a slideshow presentation of it with music, and we had, you know, pictures, and I had done storyboards and all that to try to sell it. And it still, you know, we weren't getting off the ground. Well, then we get a call from somebody who said, my uncle knows some guys who are Mormons up in Utah, and they need a tax shelter, and they have to write off $1 million. And they were thinking about, you know, doing it as a movie, you know, just do a movie, and then, you know, after the movie is done and then they take a loss on it, you know, then they can, you know, take the company apart, you know, go bankrupt with the company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but they actually have the money. Oh, yeah, they got the money. You know, you just got to convince them here's the right movie. So I went up to Utah with my slideshow thing, and I like doing it in this guy's house in his kid's bedroom on the wall, you know, with corpses and stuff, and I'm going, what am I doing? I've lost it. I mean, this is just absurd. But at the end of it, the guy says, could you be ready to start shooting in 3 weeks? And I went, yeah, sure. You know, I'm thinking, holy shit. You know. So, you know, we hit the ground running and, you know, shot it here in L.A. and just very fast casting. And, you know, I was, you know, looking for the All-American Blonde to play the lead, and Meg Tilly came in, and, you know, I was just blown away by her acting ability, but she wasn't at all what I was thinking of, and turned out, you know, she was an incredible choice. And the rest of it was just going, okay, how do we do this, you know, for $1 million? And it's like, oh, you know, actually, it's going to be $850,000. Oh, yeah? Okay. So, then, you know, we're cutting more things out of the script, trying to turn it around and pull it off in 28 days. And, you know, we finished the movie. And as soon as we finished, the editor just kind of pieced it together. But because, as I said, I shot this Cinemine technique where so much of it was silent that, you know, we had no music. There wasn't anything to put in there. And they put it together on a 3/4-inch tape, and they sent it down to the Bahamas, and it showed on television down there in a way that it, you know, it was a loss, so that these guys could say, yeah, we made this movie and we showed it and made no money. So they could write it off for their tax purposes, and I don't understand all that, nor do I really want to. And then they gave us back the movie and said, okay, boys, you know, now you can put the movie together however you want to do it. So, you know, that's we put it all together, and then somebody came in and bought their company, and he then came and took the movie after we finished it, you know, added some stuff, which we really were mad about, and we went out and saw it up in Colorado in a sneak preview, and we went, it's completely screwed up the ending, and took out the beginning the way we had it and turned it around so it just, you know, was not at all what we intended. So we fought and fought and then ended up shooting with on our own dime, you know, a different ending that we could do with a tiny piece of the set, and, you know, with the ending with the corpses falling. But it wasn't, you know, what we wanted to do because we would have needed to go back in the mausoleum, which we couldn't afford to do. So it all, you know, we got it done, and was a friend of our DP, and he was looking at it, and he goes, when are you guys coming out with this thing? And we go, I don't know when they're going to release it, you know. And he goes, well, you better hope they're going to release it soon. I said, why is that? And he goes, well, I saw some footage of Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist. He said, there's a lot of similarities here with the corpses and all that stuff. And I was like, really? Oh, shit, Spielberg's doing something like this? Yeah, well, it's not exactly the same, but it's sort of, you know, got some of those elements. So, of course, you know, our movie didn't come out till 6 months after, you know, Poltergeist, so... we opened in January, which was a perfect time to open, you know, small horror movie because, you know, you had no competition. Everybody was, like, off on the Oscar films and stuff. So it actually did, you know, quite well in its, you know, first couple of weeks. Again, figuring that there was very little publicity, you know, some TV ads, and, you know, it was just that audience that went to see it. And they, you know, again, it was a period when I really regret most of the audiences today didn't see what those 80s audiences were like, but they'd scream and yell and jump out of their seats and go up the aisle. And I mean, I put a lot of jokes in those movies because the audience always talked back to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially like if you went and saw it, you know, in the black community, you know, they were like part of the movie, which was great fun because you were at an event. You know, it wasn't just sitting there quietly watching a movie, you know, mm-hmm. you were like a sports event, you know, it's like, you know, move, motherfucker, move, you know, and it was just great stuff. So, I mean, all those little things where, you know, like in One Dark Night where she's coming down the hall and going, you know, kitty, kitty, you know, calling for her friend, there would always be some joker that would go, meow, and the whole audience would laugh. And then just as they finished laughing, there was a jump scare. So it was all sort of planned for, you know, audience's participation in it. And it, you know, as I said, it did quite well, and then it, you know, kind of disappeared, and then I think it was HBO bought it to release it on VHS and Beta and all that stuff, and then the rights, you know, there was no rights to it. Nobody really owned it, so if you look on IMDb, you'll see under One Dark Night, there's about 18 different titles for it, because every country, you know, Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, they all renamed it and just released it and took whatever profits they could from it and just had it called it something else. So it was took forever to get it on DVD here because mm-hmm. everybody didn't know who really owned the rights, and so nobody wanted to take the risk of, you know, bringing out the DVD and then getting sued by someone. So finally these guys, you know, what's their name, Media Busters or something?
Oh, yeah, Media Blasters.
Blasters, yeah. They were the ones that had the balls to say, no, we're going to roll the dice and see what happens. And they go, where's the negative? I said, somebody threw out the negative. There is no negative. And it's like, okay. So they had to piece the film together with, you know, whatever footage they could find, which is why it's so scratchy and, you know, looks like a grindhouse movie. Mm. And I've come to go, well, okay, now you're seeing it the way I looked at the cheap theater, so what the hell. But, yeah, there's just not ever going to be a good copy of it because of no negative. And then they took that editor's cut and called it the director's cut, which it wasn't. And then Mike Hawes had done some like video camera stuff of, you know, behind the scenes and things, which went on the second DVD, and then they put in like a little clip of the movie, you know, a piece of the 35 millimeter film. So for whatever the cost was, you know, you got all these little bonuses, which I thought was, you know, cool for any of the people that were, you know, fans of the movie or discovered it. But the biggest thing that I've come to find out about the movie is, since we had no sex, no blood, no profanity, it got a PG, which was never our intention. I mean, we really thought it was going to be, you know, an R-rated. There was no PG-13 in those days, so it was going to be either, you know, PG or R. And the Motion Picture Rating Board gave us a PG. So all these little kids got into, you know, their grandmas took them, you know, they saw the trailer and go, oh, this is cool. And they went in, and it scared the shit out of them.
Yeah.
So now some of these guys are like executives at studios or, you know, producers and stuff. And it's so funny because I'll come in and they go, God, I thought you were like 80 years old or something. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, I saw your movie. I was like 8 years old, man. And it just scared the hell out of me. And, you know, and I thought, this is weird. I mean, this is really weird. I never thought about that, you know, that the PG would cause, you know, little kids to see it. But, you know, it's sort of cool because, I mean, the things that most kids got scared with in those days were sections of, you know, Disney's movies, you know, that were dramatic and traumatic. And then, of course, the, you know, the horror movies they could see on TV. And, you know, now it's obviously, you know, kids get into everything, so it's not that same forbidden thing like it once was.
Yeah, there's like a whole generation of kids that were scarred by that movie now. But
yeah, that was the thing with those things is that, you know, I always looked at them as a roller coaster ride. You know, when the carnival comes to town and you got the fun house and it's like, you know, you got the guts to walk through it. You know, it's going to scare you. You might have some nightmares, but wasn't it fun if you were able to go through, and better yet, if you could take a girl through and she was climbing all over you as you walk through. And, you know, it's like a, you know, great way to bond. So, you know, and still in the movies, that was the case too, is that, you know, girls had their heads, you know, down in guys' laps, and the guy with a shit-eating grin on his face, you know, could sit there watching it, and she couldn't watch it, and, you know, what's going on, what's going on? It's like, well, look up, baby. You know, terrified. But as I said, I go to these movies still every weekend, and I just don't see that reaction like they used to get. You know, people are just so much more kicked back. You know, I'm hoping somebody comes along and does another, you know, Exorcist or Sixth Sense worked. Probably the last thing I saw that I saw the audience really terrified.
Mm-hmm. So, for you, though, did One Dark Night, did that lead to Friday the 13th? Or did somebody see that movie and then recommend you for that? Like, how did Friday the 13th come along?
Well, that was, you know, after I finished One Dark Night, it became, my calling card. So, because I, again, didn't have any other directing credits other than stage stuff and my little shorts and things. So I had to go from place to place, you know, with the film cans, you know, trying to get people to watch the movie and try to get a job. And eventually I got like a little small picture at Paramount, you know, that was a kind of a thriller. And then the picture fell apart. And then one of the producers at Paramount said, What would you think about doing one of the Friday the 13th? And I go, you know, I only saw the first one, which I thought was good, but I don't know if I want to, you know, do one of those. It's just nothing that I really believe is a good cinematic thing or whatever. And then, of course, I had my agent going, are you crazy? I mean, this thing's going to open like in 1,800 theaters. They're going to make it, you know. And, you know, what would convince you to do it? And I said, well, if I could put comedy in it. And it's like, well, we'll ask. And they said, okay, just don't make fun of Jason, and you can put your comedy in it. So that's kind of how it occurred. You know, it's like it was $3 million, and I said, well, I really want to press the edge of the envelope and have Carlite as well as Knight, bring in little children. I mean, everything that the other ones didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the big thing, of course, was the tribute to Frankenstein from my influences of having a lightning bolt bring him to life. And so through the whole movie, there's, you know, little tiny in-jokes and references to so many things that, you know, inspired me and or were, you know, personal. You know, like the Sheriff Garris is, you know, a tribute to my friend Mick Garris. And, you know, through the whole picture, there's, you know, names and things that were in that only, you know, I know. Or if you listen to the commentary, you know, you hear the backstory. But, yeah, that's how that occurred. So it was really kind of a fluke, and I never thought it was going to do, you know, what it did over the years. I mean, I still get fan letters every week, and I go places, and you know, and I guess because of the documentary, Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue, people now, you know, recognize me. And, you know, it's like, you know, that's my favorite Friday. And I go, really? Why? He goes, I don't know, man. It's just fun. You know, it's like a real film. It's fun. We had fun doing it. I mean, we had a ball down in Georgia. You know, we were in Covington.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I love the South. And I've done so many movies down there. And but that one was like, you know, we were all young and crazy. And we were shooting six nights a week, you know, all night. And then we'd go into Atlanta on Sunday nights and, you know, party in the dance place, you know, till the sun came up on Monday morning, and sleep all day Monday and start to work again on Monday night. So, I mean, it was a great time.
Now, as far as, like, the creative control behind the film, did Paramount sort of push you to do things that you didn't want to do, or did they just give you pretty much complete control over the movie?
They pretty much gave me complete control. I mean, I had complete control, obviously, on the One Dark Night, you know, other than, you know, take out any of the profanity that we had in there. And there was one scene where the blonde, when she took off her top, you got to see breasts, and they said, well, would you mind having turn her back? And I go, okay, fine. But, you know, there was that one touch that I wanted to put in that one. And but they left the smoke and the weed in, which I don't understand why they allowed us to do that, but they did. And then in Friday, basically, it was, Frank was very happy with the script, and I can't think of anything other than we did the first preview, and they brought in an audience, the Friday fan audience, who stood in line for 4 hours at Paramount, you know, to come and see it. And they were screaming and yelling from before the movie started. I couldn't hear anything through the movie. I mean, the noise level was just so intense. And then when the movie's over, they were still screaming and yelling, you know. And I thought, well, the combination of being drunk and stoned and everything else, they were just on party to the max. But at the end of it, Frank Mancuso came over and he said, we need 3 more kills. I said, what? We got 13 kills. And, part of my thing, I wanted 13 kills and have it happen on Friday the 13th. He goes, no. You know, I want to get 3 more in there. I think the audience wants 3 more kills. I go, how could you tell? He goes, well, you know, I've done this before. I go, you know, well, I don't know who we're going to kill. And he said, well, make up some people. You know, so I said, all right, well, I guess we, you know, the caretaker was alive, so they will kill him. Let's see, we'll see. Sissy got pulled through the window, you know, the black chick, and I said, we'll tear her head off. We'll see that happen. I go, okay, great. And then I said, I'll put a couple out there, you know, going to engage and have a little, you know, champagne out in the dark at night, and then have Jason get to them too. So I was like, okay, you know, 1, 2, 3. So we shot those, and there was actually money. I came so far under budget, which I didn't know, that they could go and, you know, we could actually shoot in L.A. to, you know, add those things. That was the only thing that was sort of like added, and certainly I didn't mind it. But the big problem we had was with the ratings board, because we had 9 screenings for the motion picture ratings board, because we were getting X, 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 X every single time. And it wasn't that mine was that bloody and gory and over the top. It was, you know, and I didn't realize this, when you make people likable and then you make these kills really intense, even though they might not be gory, that really bothered the ratings board. So we had to just keep taking frames out, you know. Like the thing they really hated, which you saw nothing, was when he bent over the sheriff backwards,
mm-hmm.
and snapped back. I mean, that we had to keep cutting and cutting and cutting. You know, you still got the effect at the end, but, you know, I really showed him go all the way back, you know, and then have that happen. But there was no blood, nothing, just a horrible snapping sound. And crushing the one cop's head, you know, you actually saw the skull pop up and, you know, some brain matter come up. I think that's on the, the added features on the last Friday release. But yeah, there really, it wasn't like big sequences. It was just bits and pieces. And it was just got frustrating because it's like, come on, guys, this is, you know, does that really make a difference? And I think they just, they had it in for these movies.
Yeah. Another thing, too, that, I mean, going from part five to this film was the Tommy character, too, which was, I guess, Tom Matthews in part six, and then I think it was John Shepard in part five. Was there any attempt to get him back that he just didn't want to do it, or was did you want to cast Matthews?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I really, of all the ones, I did not like part five, mainly because at the end of the day, it wasn't Jason. You know, it was a revenge movie from this guy, and yet you were led to believe with everything that happened that it was Jason. And it just, you know, it just didn't to me have the sense of, you know, story and character and things that, you know, part four had, you know, which was kind of the wrap up. So I basically looked at all the movies and decided, okay, you know, Jason gets killed in part four, and I'm going to forget about part five, except I would like John to do it, because I think I felt like he was a sensitive actor that just didn't get a chance to really do anything, you know, terribly interesting in that. Well, John had, at that point, I don't think he still is, but at that point had joined some religious group. So morally, he did not want to go and do a Friday the 13th. So it wasn't about money or anything. It was just, you know, just morally didn't want to do it. Later, I heard he had an agent that wanted twice the amount of money, and Frank Mancuso wouldn't pay for it. But, you know, I don't know if that's at all true or not. But the thing about him being religious was something that I've heard more than once. So I don't know. I think it's probably a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't do it. Well, if you pay me enough, I'll do it. But so that didn't happen. And so, you know, I went looking for somebody, you know, to play that part. And, you know, Tom came in and read for me, and I just thought he had all the right stuff. Plus, you know, having done Return of the Living Dead, he already had a bit of a, you know, horror following.
Right.
And the rest of it, yeah, was just, you know, I know I just wanted to have a, you know, sassy blonde that, you know, was tough and could, you know, kind of pull him along and then make sure that, you know, he did all the really brave things at the end, having to face Jason and all that, even, you know, and call Jason a, you know, maggot head and, you know, all the stuff to provoke him, you know, kind of all the things that you shouldn't be doing to the monster.
Yeah.
Crazy enough to do. But,
now,
yeah, that's how that happened.
Now, you mentioned the ode to Frankenstein, the opening of the film, which is definitely one of my favorite scenes in any Friday the 13th movie. Tell us a little bit about, like, you know, how that scene went as far as shooting goes. And I know that I believe it was C.J. Graham that was Jason, and had, I think he was covered in maggots throughout part of that scene there.
Well, yeah, that, again, was the magic of illusion. You know, there was a bunch of elements that kind of came together on that. The nighttime cemetery, as you know, in the South, they're very respectful of the cemeteries.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if it's any of the ones like where we were around that were Civil War veterans and stuff. So they really did not want us there at night, period. So the daytime thing that you saw, you know, was we were sort of limited to a certain area that we could work for that, you know, time in his car, and his truck comes in with the police following him and stuff, you know, which was the real cemetery. But then the night thing that opened it was actually a field that had a really kind of cool tree. And so we built a little cemetery with the fences and things. And it really wasn't that big, but by the use of changing lenses and the way I moved the camera and stuff, it made it, you know, feel larger. And then we had a, you know, special effects guy there that, you know, rigged up the... you know, the explosion on, you know, when the lightning bolt hit. And then, of course, the lightning bolt was actually put in by the special effects guy who did which is the Star Wars where the old guy comes out? Was that the second one with the electrodes coming out of his hands and he's,
The Emperor, Empire Strikes Back, I think.
Right. So I got the guy who did that electrical bolt, you know, to come in and do our, you know, lightning bolt. So I thought he did a, you know, really nice job. And then, you know, we had a, you know, rain machine there and, you know, kind of put all, you know, all those elements together. But in the coffin, the close-up when Jason opens up his eyes and the maggots are all around him, that was actually one of the special effects guys, special makeup guys, that, you know, he was the only one that would sort of had the guts to put the mags all around him and close to his eyes and shit. No one else wanted to do it. So, you know, it's not CJ, and it's, you know, he really had balls, but, you know, mm-hmm. it worked great for the thing. And then the rest of it was all CJ coming up out of the grave and things. What else did you want to know?
Well, I guess, I mean, the one thing, too, is how did CJ come about to begin with? Like, where did he come from? How did you cast him?
Well, that, again, was something that was not necessarily my choice, but ended up being a real blessing in the thing. We started the movie with the stunt man, Dan Bradley, playing Jason. Now, Dan Bradley certainly, I'm sure, has no regrets that he did not finish the movie as Jason, because he's now, like, the premier second unit action director. I mean, all the Bourne Identity movies. I mean, any of the big action, big expensive action movies. I mean, he's the guy that puts those sequences together. And he was already a really, you know, cool stuntman and stunt coordinator. So it was like a real, you know, great thing to have him do the movie. But, you know, he wanted to play Jason. So I thought, okay, cool. Now, he's a kind of a bigger, bulkier kind of guy. And the problem was, which I didn't realize, is that, you know, the costumer kept coming to me saying, he's got to stay away from the craft service. He's, you know, we keep letting out the pants and letting out the shirt. He's getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, we didn't have all the wardrobe wherewithal, you know, in this, you know, Covington, Georgia, you know, that keeps, you know, changing things. And, I mean, if you go back and look at the, he's only in the daytime footage, you know, when they're going after the, you know, the paintball guys. That's Dan, who did all those sequences that were in the day. But you can see, you know, the shirt buttons kind of pulling and, you know, a whole different body type than CJ. So, yeah, you know, I was still very loyal to keep the guy, you know, that you know, started the movie. And Frank Mancuso, you know, gave me a call and said, well, we've removed Dan and we're bringing in another guy. I said, what? Wait a minute, you know. And it's like, I didn't even talk to Dan about this. He goes, no, you know, we just took care of it, you know, and I'm just not happy with the way Jason's looking. I was like, all right, who's this other guy? And he goes, oh, you'll love him. He's really great. He's an ex-Marine. And I said, well, what has he been in? Nothing. Wow. The guy's never done this. What about, has he done stunt work? No, but he's a Marine. He'll do whatever you say. And sure as shit, he did. I mean, he came in there and everything was, yes, sir, you know, and he was like, you know, the Terminator. I mean, you know, he had this great, you know, stance, and, you know, he moved like almost like a, you know, an undead machine and a, you know, a killing machine. And pretty much anything I told him, you know, to do, he'd say, yes, sir, and go and do it. And, you know, he almost killed Nancy, my wife, in that one sequence with the, when he tries to spear through the windshield of the Volkswagen.
Right.
Yeah, but the redhead Nancy is, you know, was my wife, and the other guy, of course, is Tony Goldwyn, that's gone on the big things. But, you know, I told CJ, look, you know, just aim at Nancy. She's sitting there behind the wheel, and she's going to get out of the way. And we could only do it once because we only had one windshield, you know, to break. And, you know, he says, well, are you sure it's going to break? And I said, just hit it with all you got, man. You know, I'm sure it will. So, you know, it was like action. And, you know, he starts to move the spear and Nancy starts to, you know, go to the side. Well, just instinctually as a soldier, he followed her with the spear right towards, you know, where she was going and went through. And, I mean, just missed her, I mean, by, like, inches. And he was like, oh, I'm so sorry. My instinct just kicked in. And it's like, no, you didn't nail her. That's fine. She's fine. You know, it made for a hell of an exciting shot. But, oh, my God, you know, that's, again, the difference between, you know, a stuntman and somebody real. And the same thing with the stunt guy that I got down there that did the RV, the, you know, that big jump to where the thing crashes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was just a good old boy, you know, and he showed up in like an Evel Knievel outfit. And, you know, yeah, I'm going to make this thing fly for you. And, you know, I said, have you ever done this? Hell no, but it's going to be fun. And, you know, it was the last shot of the movie. And, yeah, I mean, he sent that thing flying, you know, and then when it crashed, and it's like beep, beep, and it's like, oh, God, I hope he didn't kill himself. I don't want to have a guy die on this thing. And, you know, he came out, and he was kind of wobbly. He says, you know, is that all right for you? And I said, that was great, man. So, you know, that kind of stuff, it was just, I don't know, every day there was some sort of crazy thing like that where it's like, are we going to pull this off? Oh, yeah, sure, let's keep going. And got through the picture.
Jeez. The other thing that about the movie that I really, really like, too, I mean, aside from the cinematography, which I think if you look at Part 5 and Part 7, you definitely say that Part 6 is the better filmed of any of those. Like, I mean, in terms of the way it looks, it actually looks like a, I don't know, I hate to say it, but
like a
real
movie.
Yeah. But the other thing that nobody ever talks about is the soundtrack, which was the Alice Cooper song and stuff like that, too. Did you have any input into that? Did that just come about? Like,
well, that was, again, a really fortunate thing because Alice was a big fan of the Friday movies, loved Jason and things. And I think he had just changed record labels or something. Something had to do with Paramount. And so, again, and all being very respectful to me, you know, Frank Mancuso Jr., you know, said, well, what do you think Alice doing the title song for this thing? And I go, has anybody ever done that? And he goes, no, I think it'd be really cool. And I go, yeah, I think it'd be really cool. Sure. So the first version of The Man Behind the Mask was like a really hard driving rocker piece, which I thought was really great, you know, and because it had a lot of energy and really kind of kicked ass. But Frank, you know, did not like it for some reason. And they kind of went in the studio and kind of slowed it down and kind of changed the thing so it had a little more of that, you know, beat to it, which at first I didn't like, but now I've kind of come to, you know, like it because it's, you know, what is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was listening to Alice's, you know, album, and I thought, God, there's all these other really cool, you know, Teenage Frankenstein and these other songs. And I said, you know, is there any chance, you know, we could get these songs? And he said, yeah, we'll ask. And, you know, Alice was like, yeah, hell, man, that'd be great. So in they went. So suddenly I had, you know, like, I guess, 3 or 4, I guess it was, additional songs with that. And then found some other, like, local band that, you know, did that, what was that thing called? Thing that Darcy DeMoss in the RV when that no that was Teenage Frankenstein. I don't know where that song was. There was one additional song from some other kind of unknown rock group that was in there as well that I thought these guys were going to go on to do something that ended up not. But yeah, I wanted to direct the video because I've always wanted to do a music video. It's the one regret in my career that I've not been able to do that coming out of rock and roll and stuff, but they had to use all the people that were part of the record label as a whole, kind of, you know, almost like a commercial, you know, you had to use the people that were already accepted in that club. So, you know, I thought the video could have been so much better than it was. You know, it's again one of those little regrets, but, you know, since the movie came out, you know, that's all that mattered to me ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there was a conscious effort too on my part that the cinematography looked really good. I don't know what's happened to John Cranhouse, who did that. He hadn't a whole lot of credits, but he seemed to get what I wanted to do. And, you know, we really worked towards, you know, making it, you know, interesting looking and trying to create moods with the lighting and, you know, rather than just, you know, especially Part 5, you know, was so poorly done. And I just don't think Danny Steinman, you know, gave a shit other than the, you know, the fucking scenes.
Yeah. We've actually had him on. I'd probably agree with that too.
Yeah,
he pretty much says as much.
Yeah, he really enjoys shooting the nude women. I know that.
I think he came out of porn.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
yeah.
His background, and you know, my editor. I mean, he didn't want to do my movie because he says if it's going to be like the last one, he goes, I've got kids, and I just can't go to work and cut these scenes that were, you know, just, it was like cutting porn scenes and things. He said, I just couldn't do it. So I said, no, I'm doing really an homage to horror as I'm trying to make a horror movie, as I'm doing a tribute to James Bond and everything else in there. So I said, you know, I'm trying to do fun. I'm not trying to repulse anybody.
Yeah, I believe it was the first Friday film. I don't think it had any nudity in it, did it?
No, it didn't. Oh. And that, again, that one scene with Darcy DeMoss on Tom Fridley in the RV wasn't, you know, it was intended for her to be topless. And she said to me, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable doing this. And I went, really? You know, and she's like, shit. Okay. So let's just, you know, let's put something that's sort of, you know, half falling off of you and you know, put it on top and just make it funny that you're bouncing to the music and he's trying to hold on till the song's over is what she needs. You know, and then like the next, like two movies later, she's doing softcore porn. You know, she's gone on to do all these, you know, things where she's doing lesbian scenes and all this other stuff. And I thought, what happened to the little Miss Innocent who couldn't take her top off for the Friday? I mean, I've been, you know, that's one thing that wasn't totally intended, but then in, you know, when it got down over the years and people go, yeah, well, you broke the rule, you know, it wasn't like we saw breasts and then he killed her. And I said, well, I never really bought that as a rule. I mean, somebody came up with that notion. And I just think, you know, the guy, I mean, this is very simple. You know, you killed the guy's mother, he's going back to the area and he's going after anything that's teenage and in his way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, that's it. I mean, that's the monster that's just, you know, vengeful because of something that happened to him when he was a child. And, you know, he's not waiting for the sex, but if he stands there and he sees it, you know, he does something about it.
Now, another aspect of the movie that I know it sort of separated from the other sequels, at least up to that point, was the marketing behind the film. And I remember the poster art was extremely detailed compared to, like, you know, the previous films and stuff like that. Did you have any influence on the marketing that way, or is that just
something? No, none. I think part of that came out of, too, the one time Frank Mancuso showed up on the set, because, I mean, he completely left me alone. You know, just make the movie and keep it under budget and, you know, make it great. It was he came down to shoot, to be oversee and, you know, shoot with me the teaser trailer, you know, and I guess you probably saw that, you know, where, you know, the camera's kind of moving towards the gate, and kind of goes through the gate and towards the Jason tombstone, and then the coffin pops up and opens up and it's empty, and then Jason lives, the words come out through it. And that was something that I think Frank thought up, so he wanted to be there to help execute it. So I don't think there's ever was a real trailer for the movie. I think it was just that teaser.
Mm.
I certainly have never seen one. But then based on that sort of feeling is what I think they then took over into the marketing of the movie there, so that it had a, you know, more of a kind of a gothic horror quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, less slasher and more about, you know, Tombstone and, you know, bringing somebody back from the dead, which I like because, you know, I didn't want it to be just like, you know, come and watch somebody slash throats, because that wasn't the kind of movie I made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely I don't know if you remember the posters and stuff like that from previous Friday the 13th. It's basically just text. It was like, you know, black poster with, you know, the Friday the 13th font.
Right.
And this one is really, it's just an amazing, I remember it was one of my favorite, you know, movie posters from that era, I guess.
Yeah, it's fun, too, when some, you know, fans or if I'm at these conventions and things where they, you know, bring it up to have me sign it, and they've got, like, you know, all the cast and crew and stuff, and, you know, everybody's all over that tombstone on the poster.
Yeah.
It just looks very cool. You know, it's a great poster to sign.
So, when did you see the film? Like, what was your reaction the first time you saw it? Imagine you had they had a screening for it at Paramount and stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the thing I said earlier, that, you know, we had brought in this, you know, this crowd, and I was frustrated. I can't say I was pissed, because they were having a great time, and the bottom line is you want the audience to come in there and party, but they were already partying before, you know, one frame of the film rolled. So it was like, you know, they're not listening to the dialogue, they're not hearing the jokes, you know, all their judging is when they see a head roll or something happen, and then, you know, the whole place would just scream, you know, much louder. So, it, you know, that was no way to really judge the movie. So the first time I actually saw it was on Hollywood Boulevard, you know, and, you know, purposely went to, like, one of those, you know, first shows of the evening. And it was sold out and, you know, kind of just stood in the back and, you know, was thrilled to watch the audience's reaction, you know, and then jumped from there to a 10 o'clock show, to a midnight show in Westwood. And, you know, all the Paramount executives were out there with big shit-eating grins on their faces, you know, because they could tell this would do well. And, you know, so, I mean, that you know, that was a great, you know, great sense of, you know, it works, thank goodness. But the biggest surprise was when, you know, quite a number of the critics actually said, well, you know, you can't hate a movie that makes fun of itself. And, I mean, how many movies have a character look right in the screen and say, some folks have a strange idea of entertainment? and that was one of those things that nobody really did, unless you were doing a flat-out comedy like Ferris Bueller or something, you know. So stuff like that, you know, again, I didn't know if I was going to get away with it, but it ended up, you know, working, you know, somehow it all came together.
Now, the sequel to Six, were you ever offered the director, you know, a role in that movie, or was that something you just wanted to do one?
Yeah, I didn't, you know, I mean, I was offered part four of Freddy, the one that Rennie Harlan ended up
mm-hmm.
doing. And I went in, you know, because I really did not want to do another Friday, only because I didn't know what new to do with it. And then at one point, Frank came to me and he said, you know, how about Freddy versus Jason? I said, now you're getting into some weird territory. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman and stuff. And I said, you know, well, how about, you know, let's do a spinoff of Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein and do Cheech and Chong meet Jason. We could do a doper movie at the same time, do a scary, you know, Jason movie, which I think would be great. And, you know, Cheech and Chong, they didn't have the rights to get them. And the same thing with New Line. I think had at that time, you know, the Freddy franchise. So that never happened, and Jason Meets Freddy didn't happen for another 10, 12 years. But scripts kept coming out constantly. Everybody was trying to figure out how to do that, and I actually went in on the one that was made, and I didn't like the script. I had my own take on what I wanted to do with it, and they go, "No, we like our take better." And I go, "Okay." I kind of wanted to do it because I love, you know, the Freddy movies, and they had not really been burnt out yet. You know, there had only been three of them, and this was the fourth one, and they were going to, you know, really go into much more fantasy horror, and I loved the fact that he had a sense of humor and things. But when I went into the meeting, they were already shooting, like, two units of the film. I go, wait a minute, how can you be shooting? You don't have a director. So, oh, that's the way we do it. You know, we have one start to do the miniatures, and the others are, like, doing the effects. And I go, well, who's overseeing all that? Well, we all are. All are? And so, you know, I said, I would have a problem with that because I'd love to be overseeing it. It's not that I have to do everything, but at least make sure it's all consistent with the tone and vision of it. So, I ended up not doing it. And then Rennie came in there and really kicked ass. And, you know, that was, to me, one of the better ones and probably the most successful one, I think.
Yeah, I believe it was.
Yeah.
But, I mean, transitioning, though, into TV, and one of the things I really wanted to talk about, too, was Sometimes They Come Back, just because I think that's a really underrated TV movie. I mean, I think it did really well back at the time, but you don't hear a lot of people talk about it now, but it's a great movie. How did that all come about? And
well, there's if you really want to kind of hear kind of the sort of the whole kind of backstory to it, if you go on the internet to www.modest proposal, whatever that is, proposal, proposal.com, that's a e-journal. That it's kind of a literary e-journal, and there's a book that's being done on me of, you know, from birth to, I don't know, about a year ago. And there's one that they ended up, for this e-journal, they released that chapter with pictures and stuff, you know, behind the scenes. And it basically, what the whole book is, it kind of talks about what was going on in my life as I was making these movies or what led to it. And then the Joe Madry, who's the biographer on the thing, you know, watched all my movies and put them into categories and found, you know, things that I didn't even know I was doing, you know, just unconscious things, sometimes with family, sometimes with death. Just before I made Sometimes They Come Back, my father had died, and my daughter was being born. So I had all this emotional, you know, baggage going on with birth and death. And then my best friend, we had a comedy one-man show that he did that we got a deal at Disney, and I was prepping to do that. At the same time, I was prepping Sometimes They Come Back. And Universal had me, you know, being the producer of two, you know, horror cult things, you know, She-Wolf of London and They Came from Outer Space, which, you know, again, wasn't something that I was really excited about, but, you know, kind of got that going with Mick Garris. And all that was happening simultaneously. So, I mean, once everything sort of calmed down, you know, my daughter was born, my dad died, I finished up my commitments on the Stephen show, you know, and then got to Kansas, where we shot it, I was kind of like operating on some other level. I mean, you know, we got through that, but that truly was a movie that had a curse on it. That every day something happened on the set. I mean, we had ambulances on that set, like, pretty much every day. The ironic thing, as you'll read in that article, is that, you know, we found out at the end that we were actually shooting on ancient Indian burial ground, which, you know, they said, well, if you have problems, that's probably what it was. But, I mean, you know, rocks fell, the transportation department quit, you know, lights would blow out. I mean, it was like one thing after another. One of the key actors had a heart attack and, you know, could barely move, but he insisted on doing the role anyway. And it was just one thing after the other. It was just amazing that we got through that thing.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, my son recently saw it. He's, you know, he's a filmmaker now. And he said, "My God, Dad, that's you. And that's so much of what you are in that movie." And I didn't even think of that at all. And then when I started seeing these pictures, and you'll see in the you know, the Modest Proposal thing, Kim Matheson and I, it's like we have the same haircut. We're like standing the same way. I mean, I know for a fact I wasn't trying to copy his look. That's just the way I look. Now, I don't know if he was purposely copying my look, but we really became like brothers on this thing. You know, it was really like he was, you know, extension of me, like, you know, De Niro, extension of Scorsese, or Francois Truffaut's, blanking on his name now, but you sort of, you know, talk through the lead actor, you know, if you were in that situation. So it has, you know, a ton of personal stuff, a ton of emotional stuff that was connected to it. And the challenge on that one was, you know, Dino's company was releasing it as a feature film, you know, in CinemaScope for Europe. So we had to frame it so that it would work for the wide screen, you know, for the European release. At the same time, he had made a deal with CBS for it to be a CBS TV movie, which needed to be, you know, 4x3, the, you know, the absolute square box thing for TV. So every time I framed the shot, I had to try to adjust for both things, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but it really is when you're trying to, you know, like paint on a canvas and, you know, you can make it this big, but you're going to lose this if you don't have it right over here. And, you know, so that was a little, you know, tough to deal with. But, yeah, the movie, you know, I think it did fine on the when it aired on TV, but it was never really designed as a TV movie. I was really looking at it that it was a, you know, feature for Europe.
Yeah.
And then the surprise was it did so well, I guess, in the market over there and when it was released on video that they ended up doing two sequels off of the thing. I've never actually sat through them all. You know, I started to watch and went, "I can't watch this." It's just,
yeah, they're not too good.
The movie was. and, you know, and then the other side of it, too, was that the script was really good, but it all didn't quite fit together. And Dino brought in Tim Kring to work on the script with me. And, you know, of course, he's gone on to do Heroes, and he's got another Fox show coming out with Kiefer Sutherland. And, you know, really great guy and really, you know, well-versed in the horror stuff. So between him and I, we kind of put more of the, you know, the family and the bond between brother and, you know, brother and brother and in the piece. And, you know, just that sense of, you know, it really, I mean, what the guys originally put together for that, where the writers were, they did Jewel of the Nile, and, you know, they were big, expensive writers. but they sort of like did the best of Stephen King. You know, there was like the evil car, and there was the teenagers from, you know, Stand By Me, and, you know, it seemed like it had all these different elements, because the short story is not very, you know, there's not a whole lot there. So it had to sort of be, you know, kind of Frankenstein together to try to make a story out of it, but I felt the emotion was the thing that needed to just carry through. You know, I couldn't really explain the ghosts. I liked the idea that they were human, and yet they could, you know, not be there certain times and be there other times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I have a whole theory about, you know, ghosts that are, you know, really comes off of more an energy force, you know, that we just, like, radio, you know, waves or television or internet. I mean, it's stuff we just haven't discovered how to recreate it, but it's out there because, you know, try to explain 100 years ago that you could put images in a box, you know, and you could watch it or, you know, hear something that, you know, how am I hearing this? It's just coming out of nowhere. I mean, all those things that we take for granted, I mean, you go back, it's like that was absolutely impossible to even conceive of. So I think the same way, you know, we're going to figure out what all this energy that is out there that, you know, we just haven't, we're not able to recreate it on a regular basis, and that's our ghosts, and that's our feelings, like that when you feel something's about to happen before it happens, and all that stuff that we call the paranormal. It just hasn't been worked out. So I wanted to have the movie have a lot of that sort of stuff to it, that it wasn't completely logical, but emotionally, the bottom line was he lost his brother from these guys, and now they're back to get him,
mm-hmm.
because he was the one that took the car keys. And that's pretty much it for me. All the rest of it is like, you know, a cool car that has fire shooting out of it. You're going to fuck with your family like bullies do, because, I mean, you know, bullies are bullies. I mean, they, you know, they have a great time just messing with you, and that was sort of the fun of that movie, too, was I love those three guys. And
oh, yeah.
Turned them loose, you know.
Did Stephen King, did you have any kind of feedback from him while making the movie?
While making it. He saw it when it was done, and yeah, he really liked it. You know, he thought it was very cool, and I think it was his son who, you know, gave us the quote that, you know, it looked like the best of Stephen King with all the different, you know, references to other Stephen King movies, because it was a short story that had to be padded out. But, you know, Stephen's stuff, you know, I have a very, you know, strong opinion about his stuff, you know, works, but doesn't work all the time. It's, you know, it was something we'd never seen before. And Stand By Me, it was so emotional, it worked. And Dead Zone, to me, worked incredibly well because I so cared about the Christopher Walken character and the relationships and stuff. But then, you know, you get off into his Lawnmower Man and what was the other one with the cars that he did? Maximum Overdrive and
right.
Cat's Eye and some of these other things. Cujo worked. You know, because that dog was so friggin' scary. But most of the stuff, you know, what he does so well in his books is you hear the character's thoughts. You know, like in The Shining, you know, you heard what was going on in that kid's head. And, you know, when I saw the Kubrick version, you know, me and the whole audience was, like, disappointed because we were all there because we wanted to see the book. But then after you go back the next time, you go, okay, forget the book. Let's look at what this man did. I mean, it's an incredible, you know, horror masterpiece. Because Kubrick just totally made it his own. But King, to me, is very hard to do right, because it's so great when you read it, because it's scary because you feel like you're with the characters. When you actually try to portray it, you know, lots of times it just feels like, you know, another Halloween, not Halloween, but Twilight Zone, or, you know, those things that we grew up on that, you know, have these different elements to them, but if you don't get the characters right and don't get the story, you know, strong enough in that 90 minutes, you know, they don't, to me, work as well as the books do.
I think that the thing about that movie, too, was that is he, in your opinion, like, obsessed with that 50s era, like the greasers in that film and everything? And what made that so effective to me was is because there wasn't a whole lot of movies made where those kind of characters were kind of evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, just,
yeah.
It kind of turned the whole greaser gimmick of the 50s into like a whole supernatural element where they were actually just pure evil. I mean, they were kind of thugs to begin with, but then it turns around and adds that to it.
Yeah. Now they're empowered thugs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, to be honest, I'd have to go back and look, because I don't remember in the short story if they were 50s, you know, greaser villains or not, or if that was something that, that we put into it. I know I felt very personally attached to those guys and dressed them the way I remember the bullies in the 50s, because I was one of those guys that got bullied.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, you know, one of the cool parts in my childhood was when I got, you know, there was these guys that called themselves, you know, GTAs? Grand Theft Auto, yeah.
Yeah.
They called themselves, you know, they had these Leatherman jackets as a GTAs and stuff, and they were like Beverly Hills rich kids that had just gone bad. And, you know, they dressed like those guys. I mean, one guy had his ear missing that he lost in a fight that was cut off. Another guy was just like, you know, James Dean was his hero, except he was like an evil James Dean with his hair slicked back and the, you know, the jacket like Dean and stuff. And whenever these guys would sort of befriend me, it was like, wow, you know, like you're just making a deal with the devil here, you know. And one night they used me to be their patsy to go into the Beverly Hills Police Department and say I was the one that stole all this stuff off a police motorcycle, the gloves, the helmet, all this stuff that they stole. And they would have gone, you know, to juvenile detention, you know, if they either admitted it or if they could, the cop could prove it. But they said, no, this other guy did it. And they, you know, got me to go in and, you know, say I was the guy that did it. And of course the cops didn't believe me, and I was this 10-year-old kid. But, you know, it was that thing of, boy, you didn't want to piss these guys off, and mm-hmm. you know, you wanted to be their friends because you knew what they were capable of. So that influence certainly had a lot of effect on, you know, those guys and the way they laughed and the way they smoked and the way they, you know, lit the cigarettes with the lighter and stuff. You know, those were just such iconic things in the 50s of those guys, you know. Might become cliche now, but that was the real deal, you know, in my world.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious too. This is coming out of nothing but my own memory of watching that film too. But was that not the TV movie that immediately followed It? I mean, It, the TV movie It, was that the one that came right after that one?
I think you could be right. You know, I cannot remember. I know It was on ABC. I thought ABC had those things later, because I know Mick did so many of those, you know, The Stand and Shining and something else.
Well, as I remember, I think It came out in 1990, I believe.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what year sometimes they came out, like 91.
Well, we came out after. If it came out in 90, yeah, because we made the movie, I believe it was 90. Yeah, like in the fall of 90, because my daughter had just been born, and she was born in July of 1990, I mean August. And so she was like just 2 months old when we were doing that.
Mm-hmm. I just remember those two back-to-back being like, that was a period where everybody was really excited about Stephen King TV adaptations. That never happened again after a while.
No.
But during that time, it was like that was the thing to watch.
Yeah. I'm sure you're right. I mean, because again, I don't remember exactly, but that, you know, but I know we were, you know, we were well into making it, you know, in the 90s.
Now, I know pretty much since you've been doing a lot of TV work, different TV movies and TV shows and stuff like that, is there a possible return to the genre for you at some point?
Oh, yeah. And it's not the lack of trying, guys, believe me. It's, I mean, two things happened in my career. One, after I did, Sometimes They Come Back, because it did well on CBS, you know, CBS approached me with a miniseries. And I said, you know what, I don't watch TV. I don't know anything about that world, you know, and it was about, you know, essentially somebody stealing somebody's baby and taking it over state lines and all this. I go, you know, I have no interest in that stuff. And they said, well, this is like based on this big book and this is like a true story. And, you know, I said, but there's already been like five of those, you know, that have been done on that same sort of idea or variation of it. And for whatever reason, you know, I kept being badgered to do this thing. And I can't remember what movie I was being offered. At some point I was offered The Bride of Chucky, but I think that was, you know, because it was 91, and I think Bride of Chucky was much later than that. But there was some other sequel to something that I was being offered, and it was almost like I did not want to do another sequel to a horror franchise. And this, I could, you know, was going to go right away, and, you know, you didn't have to wait, you didn't have to worry about whether the money was going to be there. The money was there. So I said, well, let me give it a go and see, you know, what I can do with it. So I, you know, I read the book and I changed it around wherever I thought it was necessary. But the big thing was, is there was a sequence in there where they bust the lead guy, because they find blood in the room that he had cleaned up so perfectly by using luminol, you know, which, you know, glows green. So the first thing I asked is, I want to build a set. And go, well, no, we can't afford to build a set. I said, no, we got to build a set, because I want to pull the camera all the way back in this bedroom for the shot, you know, where you see, you know, what he did to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was, like, they moved the monies around so, you know, I could get what I wanted. And so I shot it as if I was doing a horror movie. You know, hand smears. I don't know if you've ever seen the scene or not, but, you know, like the woman's hands, you know, smear and splatters of blood and all this stuff. And then I had Louise Fletcher, you know, famous Nurse Ratchet, was the mother of this, of the killer, and David Huddleston was his dad, and then had a baby in a crib that was crying that was in the scene. And the camera pulled back in this very almost Kubrick-esque, you know, move, showing just massive, you know, splatter and blood and stuff, except it was all green. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't red blood.
Mm-hmm.
It was glowing green. It was absolutely surreal. And we ended the first night of this miniseries with that. After I shot it, the executive at CBS said, this is, you know, why do we hire a horror director? You know, you got to reshoot this. This is horrible. This is just ridiculous and stuff. And we said, well, you know, the real cop who was there said this is the way it was. He did? Yeah, yeah. Well, he didn't. But, you know, we had to say, so we didn't have to reshoot it. And when the thing aired, you know, it ended the night. So that was, I guess, about 11, whatever, you know, 5 minutes to 11 at night. It scared the shit out of everybody. I mean, I was, you know, I went into markets. I had a doctor's appointment the next day. Every place I went, I heard people going, did you see that thing last night with the green room? And it was the first time I went, oh, my God, the power of television. I mean, everybody, you know, was watching TV movies, and no one expected that kind of horrific image, you know, to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tuesday night, when the thing had part two, it just went through the roof. It was, you know, the highest-rated movie of the entire year. I think Roseanne was the big show that nobody could beat. It beat Roseanne. So suddenly, I'm like, you know, the TV movie king. And it's like, you know, the offers were pouring in. And I went, I don't want to do this. And it's like, but, you know, you're going to be able to work all the time doing these movies. You know, the TV movie market's huge. You know, you're going to wait 2-3 years to make a feature. Here, you can make two, sometimes three movies in a year.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, if I can pick the material, I guess if it's interesting and unique stuff, you know, I'll go for it. So the next thing, you know, was this movie with Molly Ringwald and Lee Grant and Martin Landau that was about AIDS. And I thought, yeah, I want to show what it's like to get AIDS and what the fever feels like and visualize that. And, you know, it's also a woman that, because in those days it was, you know, women didn't get AIDS. That was not true. It was just, you know, purely a gay disease. So it was like breakthrough thing, too, because it was, you know, telling people for the first time that, no, this is something that can be transmitted, you know, through the sexual act, and this is a very real monster. And, you know, that went through the roof. So suddenly I'm in a whole new world, you know, making these kinds of movies that had, you know, kind of horrible issues at the center of it. And, you know, after I did about 3 or 4 of them, you know, I was ready to go back to features, and just it was impossible for my agency to get me anything other than more TV movies, because they said, you know, why do you want, you know, you're on a roll here, and, you know, if we pull you out of this, you're just going to not work, you know, for this amount of time. Do you want to do that? And I said, well, if the project is good enough, absolutely, because I really want to be making films. Well, nothing ever came up that was very good. And it was one of those frustrations, you know, where it's like, I want to find something, but, you know, nothing came. And a couple times when something did, like I did The Unsaid, you know, with Andy Garcia, you know, mm-hmm. which is a feature that, you know, is very dark and troubling thriller, you know, that was so uncomfortable for the American, for Universal, that they ended up, you know, not wanting to release it because it, you know, it dealt with something that Europeans were fine with, which is incest, but the American, you know, people just found it way too uncomfortable. So, you know, that one I thought, because, I mean, Andy and I, we got a, like, standing ovation at the Deauville Film Festival in France. I mean, we were like the darlings of the critics over there, and I thought this thing was going to be, you know, huge in America. But, you know, a combination of the writer's strike and the actor's strike happening, and the studios didn't really have a whole lot of money to buy the, you know, films that just at that period. And the fact that it was such a dark subject, that they thought, no, people don't want to see this. It, you know, didn't quite get the, you know, the push that it should have. And then I was 2 years on the Exorcist prequel. And that was one of those ones where I thought, this will either absolutely kill my career forevermore, or if I can pull it off the way I have it in my head of doing a period horror movie and showing people how Father Marin actually became the Exorcist in his first bout with the devil, and I could somehow make it work, this could be a really interesting horror movie. And met with Peter Blatty, he went up to his house, we spent the day together, you know, talking about it. He was like, you know, if this is the piece of shit that I think it is, Tom, I'm going to go on every talk show and just trash you, the movie, and everybody.
God.
And I said, you know, listen, William, I will not do this movie. If the script is not good, if I know I can't make something, I'm never going to make something better than The Exorcist. I mean, you know, you guys have made something that is just untouchable. But I think I can make something as good as your movie Legion, you know, The Exorcist 3. He said, well, even I couldn't make that the way. They forced me to put an exorcism. There's no exorcism in that thing. That was them did a test screening and found out that the audience wanted to see an exorcist scene, so we spent another $1 million to put it in there. And I said, okay, other than that, I mean, you could see how cool this could be if we could pull it off correctly and show where Father Marin came from. He goes, yeah, but I'm telling you, if it's not great, you know, I'm coming after you. And I said, fair enough. So, you know, we did location scouts in Africa. We did casting for the little boy, you know, kind of moving along on this thing. And I was stalling trying to get a writer that I really wanted, which is this guy Caleb Carr, who did The Alienist, that book, which has still not been made into a film, which is a very cool book. I did read it, you know, about a serial killer in the turn of the century. And I finally got him, and we talked it out, and he was on the same page with me, I thought. And then he, you know, he turned in this script that was so talky and so full of stuff that wasn't scary, that was intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like my dinner with Satan. This is just not, you know, this is not a movie. This is like, you know, Larry King with Satan up here. I mean, and Warner Brothers, Morgan Creek said, wait a minute, you saying you don't want to do the movie? And now I'm like in this tough thing where if I quit, I don't get paid. I got to get fired some way, somehow. And yet I don't, you know, I'd never been fired from something, so I didn't know even how to do it. So I just kept stalling, you know, and kept stalling, and my agent kept stalling and stuff, till they finally said, you know, we got to make this. Is he on or not? And it's like, well, he really would like to just have another pass at the script. And it's like, well, we don't want to do that, so let's move on. So like, thank God.
And yeah, who made that? Was it Randy Harlan?
I think
that
it ended up being two different guys, yeah. Right? There's two different cuts.
So here's the funny thing. Here's again, supernatural. You know, is it supernatural or is it just happenstance? When I was doing research, I mean, I literally have a whole shelf of books on demonology, demons, exorcisms. I talk to, you know, priests. I talk to, you know, experts in theology. You know, Blatty gave me a tape of a real exorcism in Italy with these, you know, horrible, you know, those kinds of guttural sounds that you actually heard in The Exorcist that they, you know, they based that on. And I immersed myself into that. And I was so fucked up. I mean, it was so depressed and dark. I mean, it wasn't like I was trying to be. It just sort of, you know, it got to me. But, you know, I kept saying, okay, that's what, you know, that's what the subject is. I'm going to just have to, you know, ride it out. So So then when the script wasn't good and I left it, it was like this huge emotional weight went off of me, you know, which was very strange. So the guy that then took over was John Frankenheimer, you know, who is an incredible director, and I worked for him as his monster in that movie Prophecy years ago, Sucker in the Suit, you know, running around on all fours and stuff, because, you know, I did, took any job I could that, you know, paid something that I could be in a movie. So I think it was irony that I'm leaving the movie and Frankenheimer's going to come in there. And I thought, okay, he'll make a cool movie. He'll, you know, and he's really strong-willed and stuff. He'll change the script and things. So he's on this thing for a year. They haven't made the movie. And then he had, like, back troubles. And he went into the hospital for, you know, this minor back surgery. And he died in the hospital.
Jeez.
Had a heart attack. And it's like, what? You know. And so it was this, you know, kind of like, wow, that is really weird. So now the script came back to me, and they said, okay, well, now we lost John, you know, do you want to reconsider? And I said, well, let me see where the script's at. So I read the script. It's the exact same script. You know, there wasn't like a word changed. I said, he was going to do the script? Yeah, he thinks it's terrific. I said, okay, I can't. No, it still doesn't work. So then they brought in Paul Schrader, and I thought, okay, Schrader, Taxi Driver, you know, he's a Calvinist. He's grown up, you know, with all kinds of religious stuff. He'll put something really cool into this. He shot the script. And what I was going to make for $18 million, you know, he did... You still there?
Yeah.
Oh. He did for $40 million. And so he turned in his director's cut, and they looked at it, and they went, this is shit. This is, and they fired him. So then they hired Rennie Harlan to just add scary sequences to what he already shot. Rennie brought in another writer, completely redid it, and then reshot the entire movie for another $40 million. So, you know, now they're up to $80 million for what I was going to do for $18. And, you know, and it's still not working. And Rennie's version was all full of all these CG effects and, you know, everything that they said with me that they would never do. And so, you know, they put out the Rennie one. It didn't work. And then they waited a while and said, well, let's try the Schrader one. You know, because they showed it to some film festival crowd who thought it was so much better than the original. So they thought, well, let's take a shot at that, you know, and that didn't work. So my deal was if the movie, The Exorcist prequel, broke $50 million domestically, I would then start getting, you know, a payday. And, of course, at the time I made the deal, I thought, oh, there's no way it's not going to. You know, it made 47.
Heck, God.
So I never got a penny.
And
know,
they,
other than the, you know, for being in there. And I had to sign a gag order saying that I never worked on the movie. I, you know, didn't contribute any of the ideas, nothing. So, I, you know, when it was such a failure, I was more than happy to say I had nothing.
Yeah, and I think that they had actually released both versions on DVD,
yeah,
as I remember. Which is weird. I don't know. What's your thoughts?
That's sort of a long answer to the, you know, why did I end up keep doing TV movies? And it's, you know, these other things would come and go, or I'd go and do some theater things or just other things to kind of break it up. But it was a way to keep making movies. So at this point, with all those shows and the corner pilot show that I, you know, for ABC that I did and stuff, you know, put all those together, and it's like, you know, 40 films. And, you know, mostly the heroes that I have, you know, haven't made that many, other than you go back to John Ford and, you know, some of my real early heroes, because in those days you just cranked that stuff out. And I think, you know, Michael Curtiz, who did Casablanca, I think Casablanca was like his 81st movie. So, you know, that long of making films before he made this masterpiece, which is, you know, the only thing he's really known for.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of just took that opinion that, look, you know, if I get a chance to make movies and do what I love to do, I'll just keep doing it. And some stuff will have horrific overtones, and some will be, you know, more dramatic, or some will be a comedy. And, you know, getting fairy tale true story off the ground was another one of those, you know, took forever, you know, and it ended up, you know, I ended up producing and co-writing it because it had to be all British. But, you know, I thought the movie, for the kind of movie it was, came out very well. But the horror thing, yeah, I want to do literally a remake of One Dark Night. now that I know so much more than I knew then, and, you know, making a movie that's going to be more than under $1 million. But the bigger thing is I always was very fascinated with the Raymar character, and I felt, you know, he got shortchanged about how interesting, you know, a psychic vampire, you know, could be.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what I'm working on is to do the first part basically about Raymar and, you know, what he did and how he did it and how he seduced women and how he took their energy and how he used that for telekinetic experiments and stuff. And then this whole idea that he wants to prove that his power can extend beyond the grave. And so it's a whole, you know, taking out the sort of the teenage, you know, prank aspect that he literally sets this whole thing up, you know, to happen in the mausoleum after his death, that, you know, certain people are invited to be in there and spend the night. It's almost like House on Haunted Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Idea, and, you know, it's a question of will he do it and what will happen, and it almost, you know, because he just overamps, and the same kind of thing happens with the corpses and stuff, because still no one has done, you know, floating corpses correctly in my mind, you know, with all the technology, you know, it's still, you know, and we did it funky because we had no money. I mean, you know, we had to do shots of the feet and, you know, run a rod through them in the back and try to make it work. But, you know, I know we can do it so much better now.
Now, do you have any thoughts? Have you kept up with the Friday the 13th franchise since part 6? And if so, like, you know, what are your thoughts on how the series has headed all these years later?
Yeah, or modern horror in general.
Well, I've got two feelings about that. One, I got to say, I'm not, as much as I love Eli Roth, because he's a terrific guy, and, you know, I'm part of that Masters of Horror group. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah.
Get together.
The dinners and stuff? I mean, the group of directors that get together and have the dinners?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and actually we're having one tomorrow night again. You know, about every 2-3 months we get together. But, I mean, it's like, you know, the horror film geek's wet dream. I mean, you know, and I'm a horror film geek, so I'm sitting there going, I cannot believe I'm in this room with these people. You know, everybody from, you know, Larry Cohen in the old days of the, you know, the early 60s horror stuff that, you know, he did to, God, we had, you know, Ken Russell there, who was, you know, 108 years old or whatever he is. And then, you know, all the, you know, the guys, you know, John Landis, Rob Zombie, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, the Saw guys, Quentin, Robert Rodriguez. I mean, just on, you know, you name them, they're there, you know. And just to be, you know, to sit around at a table and just everybody kind of, you know, swap stories and stuff. And the best thing about it is that all of them are just like us, just like you guys and me. You know, we just love the stuff, and we're like little boys. You know, nobody's arrogant. Nobody's like, you know, oh, my movie. Nobody's in, like, competition with each other. There's just this incredible appreciation of each other's work and, you know, oh, are you going to do that? Yeah, I didn't quite get it, but you did a really great job with that. Or, I mean, Toby Hooper is just like an amazingly lovely, sweet man, you know, and yet, you know, here's the guy that did Texas Chainsaw and all these really, you know, sick-ass movies that he did. And, you know, and Quentin, you know, he turned to me one night and he goes, okay, One Dark Night, released on Thorn, EMI, HBO, starring, and he just started going through all my film credits. And I said, you know all this? He goes, yeah. And, you know, I love your work. And I was like, oh, my God, you know. But he's got, like, a mind like a Rolodex.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He goes, and all those years in the video store, you know, all he did was watch stuff, and he would look at the box and he'd remember everything. So, I mean, stuff like that just really makes it, you know, magical. And, you know, just, you know, Stuart Gordon, I mean, just, you know, I can go on and on. I mean, sometimes there's, like, you know, 40 guys in there, and, like, every one of them is, like, a legend in their own right, the kinds of stuff that they do. But, you know, we kind of talk about that whole thing, and, you know, Eli, of course, was, when he first started there, you know, all it was cabin fever, and then he kind of, you know, has gone on between that and the Saw guys to, you know, the torture porn franchise, which, yeah, I'm less of a fan of all the horror stuff, because to me it goes into a whole other realm, which is not so much horror as it is sort of gross and, I don't know, I mean, it doesn't build the kind of suspense. I mean, you know, you're waiting for the person to get hurt, but I don't know, there's not an aspect to it that I really find, for me, you know, that draws me to that particular part of the genre. On the other hand, Paranormal Activity and some of the, you know, the Rec. Yeah, and some of those things, I thought, you know what, they're taking the limitations of, you know, having a really low budget and using video camera. They're taking a generation who's grown up watching those ghost shows and stuff on cable and knowing what handheld looks like, and handheld tells you that this is real, and then kind of, you know, going out there and saying, well, I'm going to scare you, and it's going to be in black and white, or it's going to be in really faded, bad color, and all that kind of cheap stuff, but it's really delivering for the audience. They believe it. You know, they accept that as a reality. And I thought, well, that to me, that's sort of much more artistic, that you're literally taking something that people believe in one reality with television and putting it on the big screen. And, you know, the second Paranormal I went and saw with a bunch of, you know, junior high school kids opening night. And, I mean, they were going crazy,
mm-hmm.
you know, not as much as the old days, but enough so they're going up the aisles going, oh, my God, I can't go to sleep tonight. Can I sleep at your house? Oh,
yeah.
Well, you know, which I thought, that's great, you know.
Another one in the same vein, though, recently, Insidious. I don't know if you've got a chance to see that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was one, like, that's sort of old school, too, and that word of mouth really got that over the top as far as, like, I think opening weekend it did, like, 13 million, and then over the last month or so it's gotten over, like, $50-60 million, which is pretty amazing, really.
It's great, and, I mean, I really applaud that because they did that for a very low budget. They made a horror movie in the Poltergeist vein, you know, with other elements, you know, attached, and, you know, the possessed kid and all those things. And for this audience and the timing of the movie, where there hasn't been a movie that really kind of was a, you know, good, simple horror movie that
mm-hmm.
you can go to and, you know, and have those roller coaster scares and the actors were really good, which is, again, a huge important thing, that you care about the people and you care about the kid and you're scared of the kid at the same time. You know, they did it very right. And so I'm very happy that that's successful, and I hope it, you know, opens more doors for other people to kind of go back to the basics and just make the basics work, because that's really what the audience wants, is give me what I expect, but then surprise me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't always come up with something fresh, but you can certainly make something old seem new again.
I think it cycled out of that, too. Like, you're talking about torture porn. I think it just went in a cycle. Like, that was really popular, and then the handheld stuff was really popular, and then all of a sudden it's like the old jump scare ish kind of haunted house movies became so, like you said, they were there hadn't been one in so long that when it came back around, people were like, well, this is something different, mm-hmm. you know, we haven't seen this in forever. So it's just, I think that might be the next thing for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, I have a horror script. This young guy, 20, I guess he's 27, from South Carolina, I think, and he wrote this thing called Imitation, which is the original script is very much a David Lynch kind of movie. I mean, it's like, it's really weird. You don't know if this guy is like, you know, has some sort of mental condition. You know, what is he? Why is he seeing the things that he's seeing? Is this, you know, there's this whole obsession with death, and he's like working at this funeral home, you know, with a graveyard that's attached, and his job is he's a night watchman because graves have been, you know, robbed recently, and his job is to, you know, keep an eye on it. So he's in this world of death, and he keeps seeing things and stuff happen. So, I mean, it's very nightmarish in that kind of classic tradition of, you know, being caught up in somebody's world that's really, you know, scary and surreal. And I love that kind of stuff. I always touch upon surreal stuff in the films, but never did one just full out. You know, I don't remember Suspiria and some of the other movies that Mario Bava and those guys did. It's more in that vein, where it's more almost horror for horror's sake. But it's, I mean, there's, I mean, you know, I wrote in some pretty gross things, but they're all sort of attached to a love story. So the person that's having these things happen is somebody that he's emotionally connected to. And then it's like, did he imagine that? Is he dreaming this? Is he dead? Is it, what the fuck's going on? And, you know, we've been taking it around and getting, you know, really good reaction to it, but it's that same thing of, I just don't know if, why would this work? Because it's not like a franchise kind of a horror movie. And I said, yeah, it can be if that's, but I said, the point is, you just want to see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Insidious is one of those things I could see somebody going, are they going to buy this? I don't know. They've been watching these much more intense horror movies, and, luckily that new company had the faith to get it out there, and it worked. And Strangers, was another one I thought was really great, but Universal had no faith in it, and they threw it out at a time when it really had, way too much competition. And then little by little, people started to see it and went, yeah, this is, got a really slow build, and it's a really creepy idea. And not a whole lot went on except with, what was going on, in that house with, are they going to get her or not? And those are those things where, in better timing, it probably would have been a bigger hit.
Mm-hmm.
But, on ours, it's like, it's that, and I know I don't get upset. You just get frustrated because I know as long as it took to get, One Dark Night off the ground, and you hear all these stories about all these films, whether you're doing The King's Speech that, he wrote in the 70s and finally got it made in 2010, or pretty much anything else that really is a little different or something that we haven't done in a while that, they're a little more hesitant. You do a vampire thing now or a werewolf thing, it's like, oh, yeah, sort of like the Twilight thing. Yeah, but not quite that, But, the success imitates, success. I mean, they it's like they want something that it's already been proven, or maybe it's based on a movie that, somehow did well way back when, so you get the rights to those things and try to remake them. But when you truly try to do something original, it's tougher. But to me, that's the road worth going down, and why I did One Dark Night was nobody was doing something like that, and I felt like, I can do something that I feel that I'm not copying somebody else.
Hey, this is Tom Matthews. I played Freddy in Return of the Living Dead, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to the Friday the 13th special here on May of the Dead.
How'd you like that interview?
That was awesome. No, big thanks to Tom for coming on and talking about his whole career and spending that much time talking with us and everything like that.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely very cool to have it for actual May of the Dead, because he was the guy that brought us the first incarnation of Zombie Jason.
Yep. And then John Carl Beekler brought him back from the watery grave, and all that was, the rest was history, really.
Yeah. So talking about part six, might as well get Jess's thoughts on Jason Lives.
I don't think Jess even remembers Jason Lives.
Well, Jason Lives is the one where they resurrect Jason from the grave by electrocution, like Frankenstein. And the worm-infested Jason pops up there and starts killing the fuck out of Horshack, and he's after Tom Matthews from Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
That's the best fucking synopsis that movie ever heard. He's killing the fuck out of people like a Horshack.
You remember what he does to Horshack? He fucking rips his damn heart out.
Yeah. But anyway, Jess, do you have any recollections about Friday 13 Part 6, Jason Lives?
Yeah, enough to where, I've seen it.
You need to talk in the microphone.
I don't like worms.
Oh, that is right.
Worms,
yeah.
Gross you out.
Worms,
what about maggots?
Yeah, those gross me out even more than worms. Mm. I won't look in the garbage can afraid to see any kind of bug.
It's gross. It's hurting noodles, Jessica.
It's hurting noodles.
Ew. This is
remember Lost Boys?
Yeah, I do know Lost Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not worms. They're noodles, Jessica.
No. They're maggots. But I like anything that's being resurrected by any kind of lightning bolt.
Yeah, I always, like I said earlier, I thought that the that scene was probably one of the most memorable scenes in any Friday the 13th movie, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's the best, one of the best openings to a Friday the 13th movie, too.
It's just so hokey and, like, over the top and fun.
That's the thing with these movies, is that they're fun to watch, even if you have them on in the background, you're not really paying attention. They're fun to even just have on.
And oddly enough, like, I've told this story a few times, but maybe Tom McLaughlin, maybe he's listening in. Friday the 13th Part 6 was the very first Friday the 13th movie I'd ever seen. And it was the first one, I think it was one of the first horror movies I ever rented as a young kid, right when it came out in the video store. So it all started there with me in Part 6.
It's hard to believe, though. Is that movie, it is, it's like 25 years old now, you know.
Came out in 86.
Yeah, that's fucking amazing. Think
that's
about
the year that both Wes and I were born in.
That's true. So, yeah, I mean, after Part 6, you got Part 7, which is a movie over the years, in my opinion, has kind of went downhill over the years. Like, we watched
it. Yeah, that was the thing. When we saw it at the theater and stuff at Scarefest, and I had seen it a million times, always really, really liked it. There's something about seeing that movie again all these years later that it just doesn't work as well as I thought it did. And I guess that really has to do with the MPAA, though. They fucking censored the hell out of that movie.
And I think it's the cheapest and shittiest looking of all the Friday the 13th movies. I mean, it just looks extremely low budget, like something that you'd see on like a Lifetime original movie or something.
It does have Bernie in it, though. That's good.
Yeah. So and this was the first Kane Hodder Friday the 13th Jesco.
Wait, what was this one? The one where
it's Carrie versus Jason, kind of. The psychic girl that, you know, can move things and stuff, telekinetic girl.
I don't remember. I really don't remember that.
I'm going to fucking murder you.
I'm sorry, I don't remember.
You fucking seen that.
No, I don't.
It's
remember.
The one where the beginning of it like tells the story of that girl when she's a little girl. She accidentally kills her dad with telekinetic powers and shit.
No,
you've never seen Part 7.
Never seen Part 7.
Oh my god,
I don't even know what to say. That
get rid of right now.
You get out.
I know. I'm sorry. Oops.
So yeah, we have to go watch that one immediately then. It's the one, John Carpenter actually did the makeup effects and had like a team of people do the makeup effects too, where you could actually see Jason's spine and shit in it, like all the way up the back of his spine, and he's all like zombie-fied looking and stuff now.
Well, it sounds cool, but I've never seen it.
Well, fuck.
I know. All right.
What about Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan?
Know that one, yeah.
I love that. I seriously do. Like, I know a lot of people don't like it. That was the very first one I saw in theaters as a kid. I was only like 3.
I was still not born.
No, this was 89. We were both 3.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
He saw it in the theater in a booster seat.
Oh, Jason!
Part 8, I hated that fucking movie for a really, really long time. But when you go back and watch it now, you just got just the fact that I think it is the last of that type of Friday the 13th movie. Like, they never made another Friday the 13th movie that was in that same formula and everything after that. But it really is, like, it's not Jason Takes Anything, really. It's just, like, Jason's on a boat for
it was really annoying.
An hour, and then...
It's really annoying. And especially,
you know,
the music video and the chick with the video game, I was annoyed. The movie
I like it now, though, just because it follows the same format as all the rest of them. But
I mean, I think it throughout the... I like it when it's on the boat. When they're actually supposedly in New York, which is really fucking Toronto, I think.
Yeah, most of it is, yeah.
I think it works the entire time they're on the damn boat. But then when they... I don't know. It definitely loses something when you see Jason, you know, in the city killing people and shit. It's like... It's the cheap sequel... Something is in the city now. You're all fucked, you know. Like, they're doing the new Smurfs movie. The Smurfs is in the fucking city, goddammit.
I don't like it when things are based in big areas. Things work better when Jason is in small... If he's attacking a campground or he's on a boat, which I like the idea of the boat part because you know that there's a killer in the boat and you don't know who it is. You don't know where he is and you kind of freak out, but the when he's in bigger areas, because then you can just kind of hole up in a house and not have to worry about nothing.
Well, the funny thing about that is that that's a movie that could work every single time if you just use the same formula, but yet that was when they really, from that point on, changed the formula every single time. Like,
because he ended up in space.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
He ends up in, first he's in New York, right? And that's,
what is the deal where every fucking thing goes to New York?
I don't know. Why is everything going to space?
Well, I don't understand what the big deal is when these other killers go to New York when you're afraid in New York anyways of getting killed. There's
like
enough
all
killers
these movies, though, these fuckers go to New York. Like, you remember the fucking Mario Brothers? They're in fucking New York. He-Man. They go to New York. Like, why?
Bambi.
Bambi in New York.
Bambi on the ride in the subway.
But like I always thought that part eight was like unjustly shit upon, especially like considering the stuff that would come after part eight.
You have to admit the ending of that movie is fucking retarded though.
It is, but it's fun though. It's like stupid fun.
It
I can't even believe anybody
would have a big enough problem with part eight and not have a bigger problem with part five and not as big as a problem with part eight.
No, yeah, majority of people have a bigger problem with part five.
I don't know why.
People are stupid.
Well, okay.
They really are.
What about the sequel to that, though? You want to talk about having a problem with a movie?
Well,
because the next movie would have been Jason Goes to Hell.
Which was supposedly, again, the final Friday.
That was the final one.
And that was like what? They took like a long break, like 4 years or something before that came out.
They should have taken a longer break.
It was the New Line, too. It was the first one they did with New Line.
That movie, to me, is really not even a Friday the 13th movie. Because Jason's only in that movie for... And by Jason, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about like a Roy Jason. I mean, even the fucking character of Jason, the look of the slash and everything, is only in that movie for like, what, the last...
The first, like, 10 minutes and the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, and the rest of the time, it's just random people going around killing other people. It's
you got the Duke guy from Friday the 13th. Was it Rocky V?
Yeah.
What was his name?
The promoter. I can't remember his name. Then you had the guy that was that was supposed to be the Jason. Like, they had a bunch of shit they just threw in there in this movie that, like, you'd never heard of before. Like, you had this Jason expert guy that is like a bounty hunter.
The thing that bothered me the most about it is the whole concept where you could become Jason if you ingested this little parasite fucking thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun, though.
And then Jason has a sister in this.
Yeah.
They just throw a bunch of, like, it's a fucking piece of shit.
I think they probably ripped that off from Halloween.
Yeah, they seem to be doing the same thing with those movies, is trying to have this mythology about the movies when they really didn't need to be a fucking mythology.
I always thought, like, New Line really, really just overthought every goddamn thing. And when they did all the Friday the 13th, whatever, Jason movies, whatever you want to call them. But what were your thoughts on Jason Goes to Hell?
I don't really have any thoughts on it.
It sucked.
I didn't really care.
What about the end of it where they teased Freddy?
I didn't really care.
You still didn't care?
I still didn't care. All I know is that it's like... Even after that, they were hyping it up for the Freddy and Jason thing.
Yeah, that was like about a 10-year gap.
Did you see it? Mm-hmm. Have you seen it?
I didn't care.
The fucking, I remember the end of Jason X, like, where all the shit come, like, the visual effects stuff comes out of his body and shit. Do you remember that? Where Jason's like, oh.
All those little worms and shit.
Boo, boo, boo. Like, fucking dumb.
That they probably got from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah,
also.
That did look like Nightmare on Elm Street.
They were just picking everything from everywhere. They got shit from Halloween and they were picking stuff from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, I mean... I just think these studios, I don't know what their issue is, where they have to pump a shitload of money into a project that doesn't need it. I mean, the Friday the 13th films, give somebody a couple $1 million, hire a bunch of new actors and actresses, go to a fucking lake and shoot a damn, get a special effects team. You can easily do it for that
price.
Yeah,
but they did that in the remakes, and the remakes are pretty shitty.
No, they didn't do that in the remakes. The remakes were, like, uber expensive. That was the most expensive budget they'd ever had.
Yeah, but you hire a bunch of new actors, you got to pay them a lot of money.
I don't remember who it was that said, though, that, and this I find to be true, like, if you hire name actors in movies, then the director really is just like an employee. They're not really making, like, a statement with the movie you're making, art or anything like that. They're just basically catering to that fucking actor, whoever it is.
Yeah.
So, like, once you bring on somebody that's a name, that's known, I think that's why a lot of those movies, when they do that, turn out to be really horrible.
And I think that Rob Zombie was trying to break the mold with that, and you can see where that went.
Yeah.
That's just because that guy's an idiot, though.
Yeah, so this was like Jason Goes to Hell. The series definitely went to hell with that. It was a good, what was it, about six or seven years went by until, I think Jason X came out in like 2002.
I can't remember if it was 2001 or 2002.
I think it was 2002. Jason X, like, I don't know if you realize, you've seen Jason X, haven't you? That was delayed. I think that was shot in like 2000. And it was, I know it was delayed a while. I don't know why.
Piece of shit, bro.
Yeah.
Remind me of a Star Trek episode.
Well, the only thing I really is memorable to me about that movie is David Cronenberg's in it. And yeah. I was just like, that's fucking weird. I haven't seen him in a movie since, what's that movie? Nightbreed.
And, yeah. It had a look to it that looked like something that should be on Sci-Fi Channel, like Sci-Fi.
It did. It was completely cheap.
It did. It looked like a Star Trek, like a scary Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
It was.
And they introduced the Uber Jason, which it's funny because, like, that sort of thing just sort of doesn't even exist. Like, nobody talks about that anymore. And people at the time thought, oh, God, that's so fucking cool. And I never thought that looked cool. I was like, what the fuck is that?
There's nothing about that movie, though, that's really cool that I like.
I mean, there was a couple, for some reason, there for a while, I haven't had the urge to watch it in a long time. But it was one of those where I always wanted to go back and watch it again. But every time I did go back and watch it, I hated it. Have you got any of those movies like that where you're like, for some reason, you want to go back and check it out again to see if you might like it? You always end up hating it.
That happened to me like four times with the Zombie Diaries or something.
Vampire Diaries.
No. It was Zombie Diaries or something like that. That was, I tried to go back and see if I liked it, but it came out around the same time that Diary of the Dead came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always go back and see if I liked it, and it was stupid.
Yeah, but that was one of them for me. I mean, there were a couple things, like, it could have been a little better, but, like, yeah, that was like one of those. That was right around the time where a lot of those movies were going in space.
I remember, well, you had Leprechaun in space, Hellraiser went in space, Freddy never went in space.
Didn't they have a Prophecy movie where they went in space?
Probably.
Or what movie?
Prophecy.
I don't know.
Fucking, they sent everything into space there for a while. And then they sent everybody into the hood. And then...
I would like to see Jason in the hood. Now, that'd be fucking hilarious.
I'm surprised that hasn't happened yet, really.
Well, there was a Facebook page that started. They said if Jason Voorhees went to Detroit...
Jason takes Detroit.
Jason, I don't think that movie would be very long.
Well, they could definitely shoot in Detroit. They could shoot in Detroit, but they might get shot at while they're shooting.
I don't think Jason would last very long in Detroit.
Jason wouldn't last very long in Detroit at all.
So right after that, you had Freddy versus Jason, which they were already working on, I think, while Jason X was in theaters.
It's a fun movie, but it's friggin' stupid. I mean, you go back, we watched that movie not too long ago, actually, because we got the Blu-ray. It's like, it's wall-to-wall action, and the subplot and the stories make zero fucking sense. And even the action sequences, when you watch them back again now, you're like, well, that's a little silly. That's a little too silly.
I remember one scene in it. I can't remember a whole lot of the movie, but it was just so stupid. I was like, that's far-fetched right there for somebody to just come up with. But I think it's the Destiny's Child girl. Like,
Kelly Rowland. Yeah.
She goes, but what if Freddy was getting into Jason's mind when he was dreaming or something like that? She really over-explained exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, somebody definitely think that. Like, it was something like, Freddy's getting to Jason while Jason's sleeping. And they've joined forces and they're going to beat the fuck out of us. And she just thought of this, like, what if Freddy did this and all? And then, like, exactly what I thought would happen in that movie. Freddy is mainly the bad guy, and Jason is
because Jason is more human. He's more human than Freddy. You sympathize for one, and that shouldn't be like that.
Yeah.
If they were gonna make it versus, then you shouldn't have one where you sympathize for. Like, you don't see Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus. You don't sympathize for one or the other. You don't really give a shit.
I sympathize for myself.
I'm just saying that you can't sympathize for one over the other because you're going to be rooting for somebody.
Yeah, that's true. Check the movie out, though, when it came to theaters?
It was very memorable for me when that movie came out in theaters because that's when the whole grid had gone out. The power had gone out for, like, the 2 weeks up there when New York and Michigan and Canada and all those places in between.
All those uppity northerners.
Well, we lost power. The grid had gone out for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I remember that when that happened.
And that happened the same time as that movie come out. So we didn't have any power at all. But there were certain areas that were able to get it, and the movie theater had it. So that's where everybody ended up because it was fucking hot as hell. So
it was a packed theater.
It was all right. I mean, for what the movie was, but those movie theaters are always packed up there. So
well, I can definitely remember when we saw it. I don't know if I've ever seen the theater that packed.
No, there were people standing like up and down on the side there too. They couldn't find.
We were like on the third row. That was the best spot we could get, and like there were people sitting in I think it was completely sold out. I think every seat in the theater was full.
Yeah, the only other time I've ever seen it like that was when Batman came out, like the original Batman.
The original Batman.
That would have been 89.
That was when Jess was two. Jess went to see it and she was shitting her diapers.
Batman. So Freddy vs. Jason, Kyle actually did like that movie when it came out, but the more you watch it, the more you're like, wow, this is kind of silly.
It's kind of dumb.
Only a few parts that I remember, like the death scenes that I liked was when they cracked that guy's back in half with the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that was probably,
you know, there's
much
a
steal it,
Catherine Isabel was in it, though. I always like her.
The chick with the big boobs and then the blonde hair.
That wasn't her boobs, though. It was like a boob double.
Monica Keena? You might be thinking of Monica Keena.
Oh, I'm talking about the redheaded girl
that
was in Ginger Snaps.
No, not her. That's not who I was
But the movie, I actually remember liking the movie, but I haven't seen it in a while. I know that it does have some politically incorrect stuff in
it. That's what I was thinking. That shit was, it has homophobia in it and racism in it.
Which that shit should be in horror movies, though, in my opinion. I mean, that's like, horror movies shouldn't be PC, and that's what I kind of liked about it. I mean, I think, I was amazed at this because the Destiny's Child, girl, what is her name?
Kelly Rowland,
called Freddy a faggot in a Christmas sweater.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, she's from fucking Destiny's Child saying that.
She's like
that.
A gospel singer.
Yeah,
too.
And I remember that. Yeah, she was like, she was into that then too. Destiny's Child was originally like a gospel act, I think. And then, Freddie, shortly thereafter that, says something like, how sweet dark meat or something like that. Mm. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, they turned the whole corner right into the prejudice and everything in there.
Yeah, what's funny is the guy that made the movie was like, he was an Asian guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was Ronnie Yee. Yeah.
So, I don't know, I guess it's just the racist and homophobic nature.
I think the only reason we liked that movie so much when it came out is because we saw it in a theater where everybody was really into it.
Yeah.
But when you go back, it's just not the same. Anyway, Friday the 13th, the remake, would have been the next one then.
Ooh, and that would just came out like a couple years ago.
And we actually had Derek Mears on the show, who was Jason in the remake, too.
It's true.
I seriously don't remember a whole lot about that movie now.
I remember the symmetrical tits because that was the first time I've ever seen boobs be symmetrical.
Yeah, I actually watched the Blu-ray again not too long ago. I got the Blu-ray. I really like the movie now. I mean, it's nothing groundbreaking, but it's exactly what Friday the 13th should be.
Kind of like Sister Christian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like the beginning part of that movie. I don't mind it until the character switch, until it's the new group of kids that go in. I liked the first group of kids.
Yeah.
If they would have kept them through the entire movie, it probably wouldn't have bothered me that much.
I think of all the remakes, though, that is the one that is the closest to getting it right.
Well, definitely. If you look at the other remakes, you got Halloween, you got Nightmare on Elm Street,
yeah,
and then you got...
Because it really just had the spirit of what Friday the 13th, the original series, was. And that's, and of course, you got a lot of the younger Abercrombie types, which are going to be in there. I mean, that's just how kids are, let's face it.
Well, you have to think that's how they were then. Like, when those movies were made in the 80s, that's what it was.
They were like Sears and Roebuck models then.
Yeah, they were... That's what it was then, and that's how it is now. But it wasn't that, because you still had them where they were he was killing off the characters that you liked, and then they had the nudity, and it wasn't that bad. It was tolerable.
Yeah, I think that that's not that bad of a movie. I want to be honest. It's nothing. Probably nothing that we'll go back and rewatch over and over again. But I mean, come on. Not that bad. I was surprised how much I liked it, I think, when we saw it in theaters.
Yeah, you definitely are right, though. It's the best remake of any of those remakes.
Yeah. So that leads us to whatever. I don't know. I'm surprised, actually, that there isn't a sequel in the works for Friday the 13th, the remake.
I kind of am, too, but I'd say they eventually will do that.
Oh, yeah, they're going to do it.
Yeah, but the movie made so much money, I mean, you would think. Do it like fucking Saw, have it out every damn year.
Well, maybe they might be attempting to do it right.
No, that's not it.
These studios are all about making money. They don't give a fuck about doing anything right. But anyway, that is it. That's the Friday the 13th. That wasn't too painful, was it?
Mm-mm. No.
So I hope everybody has a happy Friday the 13th coming up. And actually, we should make an announcement about next week's guest, Uncle Bill. It's not a two-parter, again, believe it or not.
It really should be, though, yeah. Just considering the fact that we've admired this guy's work for a long time, and he definitely fits into the May of the Dead genre.
You're going to turn it down. You're going to start whispering.
Because he directed one of the, I guess, most famous, infamous zombie movies of all time. It really is like, I guess it is a zombie movie in a way.
Yeah.
We're going to have Stuart Gordon.
Stewie.
Who directed Reanimator, From Beyond, Dolls, Castle Freak. The Masters of War episode, Stuck.
He's done all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, just...
He wrote Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and we talked to him about that.
He did. And we've got an interview with him about all that shit coming up.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird that it's not a two-parter, but, like, it's one of those deals where we just got all the info from him, got it pretty quick.
Yeah, he was right to the point, buddy. Yeah. He was, like, right on target.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting... Like, I know a lot of people have been wanting us to get him... on the show for quite a while, and we finally got it after over 5 years, Uncle Bill. We've got him on the show.
Yeah, he was one of the guys. He's one of the masters of horror. I mean, one of the ones we haven't interviewed. We've interviewed almost all of them at this point, except for maybe now Craven. What? Hooper? Craven and Hooper?
Yeah. Hooper ain't going to do it unless we pay him money.
I'll buy him some root beer and some cigars if he'll shut up or whatever he like. He'll do it.
So, yeah. Everybody's looking forward to that. And, I guess that is it. I know, any other new stuff that you want to mention on here, announcements or anything?
Nope.
You've got a lot of announcements to talk about.
I do.
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, you've got the Dead Pit wedding coming up.
Oh, yeah, we already told everybody about that.
Well, we're going to tell everybody about it every week. That's how we do things.
We're engaged.
And we're going to get married at Friday night.
And we're getting married at Friday night.
And we're going to have a baby.
And we're having a child.
You're having Bucky.
Little Bucky.
Little Bucky.
Buckster.
Little Bucky. You have to put a little bow in her hair.
What?
You have another little Jess. You ought to call it. You ought to seriously call it Jess, like Jessica something. What are you going to call it?
We don't know yet. We haven't decided.
Larry.
You can call it Bucky Jessica.
We're going to call it Ethel.
Ethel. That would be killer because I don't know any young, like, wouldn't that be awesome, a little kid named Ethel? What the fuck? You know that's happened. It had to.
Yeah, somebody's got to be named Ethel walking around.
Some little girl. Come here, Ethel. You little bastard.
I'll call her Baby Jane.
No. but anyway, also, the new Facebook page, definitely, I think it's going to be way cooler, isn't it, Jess? Because you're a mod on it.
Yeah, I don't even know how to work that. I don't know how to work.
You got to figure it out.
I don't really know how to work that much. I know how to get on Facebook and my email.
But anybody that wants to go to it, facebook.com/Dead Pit Universe. It's the new Dead Pit Universe page. Go to it.
God!
So that's it. We'll be back next week with Stuart Gordon here.
Dead Pit. .com, you bitch.
You're like a hairball.
This is Stuart Gordon, the director of Reanimator, and you're listening to Dead Pit Radio.